official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. This is The Playbook with Satyar Shah and John Chang.
Right down the gut into the Philadelphia zone. Cut to the forehand and scores. Beats Carter Hart, stick side, and the Canucks have the first goal of the shootout.
Happy Thanksgiving. The Canucks were thankful for back-to-back victories to even their record at 2-2 in the season. I'm Satyar Shah with John Jang, the Playbook, a Monday turkey edition.
Gobble, gobble.
Did you have turkey over the weekend?
Did.
You did?
In my dreams.
What?
I don't eat a lot of turkey. It's not a staple in my diet. Don't really get to have the occasion to eat a ton of turkey.
So you ate it in
but
your
But you
dreams.
Know me, I've been on the record saying this. For me, I think ham is the best part anytime there's a good turkey dinner.
No,
ham is the go-to.
It was just a very odd way to say, yes, I had turkey.
In my dreams.
Did you actually, or were you just saying
No, no.
What? I have no idea what you're trying to
well,
say.
Well, yeah, because I want turkey, but I don't get turkey. It's in my dreams.
So your body can't handle turkey?
I really can't.
You know what my body
it's a big
can't
bird.
Handle? You know what my body can't handle?
Oh.
Watching the Cleveland Browns
play
football.
I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to say nothing.
Not great, Bob.
I know.
Not great.
But
not
hey,
great.
Wait, why
us,
can't we say things?
Both of us lost
something.
I've
been waiting 24 hours to say things.
I know.
We are definitely saying things.
Because I'm still in mourning.
Why are you in mourning?
Will Dissly, man.
Oh,
Will Dissly.
Ha.
My turkey.
The things that you're not thankful for. Your football team is 5-1, and you're sitting here being sad about Will Dissly. And I know, I get it. He's a player who got hurt, but you're 5-1.
I know.
You millennials,
folks, go down. The show goes on.
Yes. Next man up.
I think the Seahawks can survive without Will Dissly because they have a quarterback who right now is right at the top of the conversation for MVP. We'll talk lots of football. We're going to talk lots of hockey, of course. But yes, I'm very choked at my Cleveland Browns. I may have drowned my sorrows in one too many beverages as I watched
Gatorade.
That game and after. Yeah, Gatorade.
Yeah,
trying to stay refreshed and
get those
hydrated ahead of the show, you know, of course. So, yes, I was very angry. Browns really sucked. You can say whatever you want. If you want to rip the Browns, you want to rip me, you are welcome to do so. 650-650 Subway text line.
Can we rip the officiating?
Yeah, officiating was bad, but I mean,
that was shoddy, man.
Yeah, it was horrible, but I mean, it starts and ends with the Cleveland Browns making lots of mistakes. Freddie Kitchens looking very much out of his depth as a rookie head coach. I thought Baker was fine, but also give the Seattle Seahawks credit because, like Big says, every Seahawks game. Go on.
Well, I was going to say every Seahawks game is the same. Every Seahawks game is different. But if we're calling a spade, like that was kind of a lucky win for the Seahawks.
Oh, yeah, no, it was.
It was 20-6.
Wait, did you just say they were lucky? Oh, why aren't you angry?
Well, because they had a blocked punt and three tipped interceptions.
I'm only giving you a hard time for last week or a couple.
But
weeks.
Like, you can't expect blocked punts and goal line interceptions to keep coming to fruition.
No, I don't disagree with you.
Right? It's when you're down 20-6. The reason you can have deficits like that is because you have a supernova behind
center.
Behind center.
Like and you have arguably the most valuable quarterback to his team right now.
The Seahawks should have lost that game.
Oh, yeah.
Quite handily.
Yes. The story of my Cleveland Browns fandom, yes. Yes, the Seahawks should have lost, but you never apologize for having a great quarterback.
Mm.
And when you have a great quarterback that can pull you out of the fire and find a way to give you victory when it looks like you have certain defeat, that's what makes a great quarterback. So give Russell Wilson his credit. Give the Seattle Seahawks their credit. They are 5-1 on the season and still trailing the San Francisco 49ers, who are 5-0 on the season as well. So that NFC West looks to be a very competitive division, but not the LA Rams pushing. They are 3-3. So we'll talk lots more NFL and football as the show goes on. But your Vancouver Canucks, 2-2 on the season. And man, it's a lot different watching this team compared to last year. And
how good
is this Canucks team going to be? Will they, you know, ascend and be a playoff team, a real playoff team? That remains to be seen. But what is very evident through the first four games of the season, they can transition the puck, they can create chances. They look like a legitimate NHL team that can hold its own on any given night.
it's refreshing to see, because I think for so long you've been entering games thinking, boy, how are they going to possibly win this one? How can they possibly score goals? How can they possibly avoid the mistakes in their own end? A lot of that has been mitigated by the fact that these new additions have really looked strong. Like, it's been night and day to see how well that defense plays now. And I know they're still probably figuring things out, but four games into the season, when you've got two defensemen that have 3 points each, and Quinn Hughes and Chris Tanev, of all people, you just have to just sit back and say, you know what? I didn't expect it to be this good this early. And I know the first two games left you a little wanting, and certainly we had conversations about people overreacting perhaps a little bit and getting a little anxious about where the season was and how the players are coming along. But I think you're seeing from, especially that defense, 1 through 6, every single player on that defense that has played so far are giving you solid value for what their role is and the kind of opportunities they're creating for the entire line when they're out there. And when's the last time you could say that? When's the last time you could viably say all three pairings on defense were giving you reasons to win games or winning shifts, winning puck battles? It's been such a long time. Like, I think you would have to go back to probably the 2011 season, 2012, because when's the last time the Canucks had 6 viably good defensemen playing in their respective roles?
That 2012, 2013, they were in the conversation. And they were teams that made the playoffs, of course. Then they lost to the LA Kings in 2012, then lost to San Jose Sharks in 2013. And then the wheels started kind of falling off that entire defense. But we saw it until about 2013, pretty much, where you had a defense that could, at the very least, be solid all around. And they were a playoff team all three of those years, of course.
Yep.
Now, are they a playoff team? We'll see how that all goes. But one of the developing stories to keep an eye on is goaltending all of a sudden. Jacob Markstrom is taking a leave of absence from the Canucks to attend a family matter. That is, according to the Canucks on their Twitter account. So Zane MacIntyre has been called up to back up Thatcher Demko. The expectation is that Jacob Markstrom will rejoin the Vancouver Canucks on this road trip, which they're heading out east starting on Thursday against the St. Louis Blues in St. Louis. Then they have back-to-back games in New York. So, Thatcher Demko, all indications, will get his first start of the season tomorrow night against the Detroit Red Wings at home. But Jacob Markstrom, him being away for personal reasons, when this news came up that Jacob Markstrom, that Zane MacIntyre was recalled, the initial response was, well, Jacob Markstrom's been getting some work done post-game. We've heard he's been battling something, but apparently this situation is not related to a health issue. It's related to a personal matter for Jacob Markstrom and his family. And considering it is Thanksgiving Monday, and also, you know, just, and he's a human being in general, we certainly hope everything is okay with him and his family.
Yeah, exactly. Don't want to speculate on what might be the issue at hand here, but, you know, besides that, you just want to make sure him, his family, everyone, going to be okay. Don't really know any further than that. And for now, I think the Vancouver Canucks will happily give their solid starting goaltender some time off, but they'll miss him. You know, he's been playing every game here, and I don't think it's a stretch to say at all, Sat, that he's probably been the largest reason why they picked up 2 wins so far this year. He's been excellent. So, of course, you want to make sure you respect the personal issues, but you want him back as soon as possible because he's been on such a good roll here.
At the same time, tomorrow, even if Markstrom would have been with the team, was the perfect time to start Thatcher Demko.
Seems that way, right?
Well, without question for me, and that's what I would have wanted to see more than anything, because now you've gone 4 games without getting a start, and it is pretty difficult to throw Thatcher Demko his first start either on the road Thursday against the Blues, the defending Stanley Cup champions, and he's been off. He hasn't played a game in over 2 weeks, Thatcher Demko.
Yeah.
And then it's hard to put him into a game without any experience on the road on back-to-back nights at 1 p.m. local starts out east when they're playing the Devils and also the Rangers. So to put him in a position to have success, Tuesday, tomorrow, always made sense for Thatcher Demko to get his first start. But now, whether it was planned or not, he will get that start at the very least. And it's important for Demko early in the season, John, to show he can at least have the trust of head coach Travis Green. Because one thing we don't want to see, and it's difficult to do when you have a goalie that plays as well as Markstrom has been playing to start the season, don't overplay him. You need him healthy and rested as well as the season goes on.
Yeah, so the number for Jacob Markstrom the past 2 years has been 60 games. Obviously not all of them start. Sometimes he'll come in on a relief duty, but 60 games in back-to-back seasons for Jacob Markstrom, which isn't a ton. Like, we're so used to, you know, 10 years ago having Roberto Luongo play upwards of like 70 games. It was kind of ridiculous, but that was the kind of goaltender Roberto Luongo was, and also the philosophy back then. We know times are changing in the NHL, and it seems goaltenders now across the league are playing on an average of 53, 55 games, starting goaltenders, that is. So that means there's lots of games here to be picked up by Thatcher Demko, and so far we've only seen him in 10 games. He is 10 games into his career, and way too early for anyone to definitively say, like, yeah, this guy's going to be a starter down the road. He still has a lot to prove. He still has a lot to show, and you can be high on him. I think he is very athletic. His technical skills seem pretty solid. He just hasn't had the experience to play enough games so far in his career because of two injuries that occurred last year, right? One at the beginning of the season where he was dealing with a concussion and they flew him back to Utica. There's a whole hoopla there. And then midseason when, again, he suffers an injury. So he missed opportunities to get more games in. But no excuse now. He's healthy. He's had a full offseason to get ready and practice what Ian Clark has been teaching him over the past year and a bit. This is a great opportunity for Thatcher Demko to come in and show that, hey, even when Markstrom isn't here and he needs a night off, don't feel like you have to play differently. I'm still going to give you the solid kind of goaltending that you need to win games. And I think that I'm excited for Thatcher Demko. It's his, not his contract year, but the fact that he was brought back on 2 more years, very team-friendly deal. He has a lot to prove, and wouldn't it be great for the Vancouver Canucks to have a situation where you have two solid goaltenders to rely on now?
Well, obviously. I mean, yeah. Who wouldn't want to have two goalies to rely on? And the Canucks have to negotiate a new contract with Jacob Markstrom as well, because he is UFA at the end of this season. And you want to see as much as possible from Demko to see how comfortable you feel signing Markstrom to an extension. I think we all agree signing Markstrom makes a lot of sense. Mm. But the question is how much money and how long is a term? And how much you're willing to spend on Markstrom will also depend on what you feel about Thatcher Demko. Because if you really like Demko, you like what you see and believe he's going to be the number one guy anyways, then you might not move off a certain number that you'll be willing to pay Markstrom. And, you know, it's just straight up speculation. But for argument's sake, let's say the Canucks have an internal cap and they say, we're willing to spend about $5 million per year, about as much as we can on Jacob Markstrom.
Yeah.
If Demko really struggles and you don't have a lot of faith in him being the goalie down the road, then you might probably spend a bit more, be willing to spend a little bit more to keep Markstrom.
Go up to six, if you will.
Or yeah. Whatever. It yeah. changes the landscape to some degree. But if Demko plays fantastic and you feel confident in him, and then all of a sudden the negotiations with Markstrom aren't going well because you don't feel comfortable paying him the amount of money he would want, then you have options. And having options is the best thing for an organization that has not had enough options the past few years.
Michael DiPietro, Jake Cayley, Artur Silov, Zane McIntyre, who was just called up here, right? And to an extent, Richard Bachman. But you have so many goaltenders now in the system.
Yeah, but just because you have them in the system doesn't mean it's going to necessarily translate this year or
nope,
next year.
But it's
and
like,
that's the thing.
It's like draft picks. You just want as many of these lottery tickets as possible. And certainly there's a situation where none of those young goaltenders pan out. But you have a lot of them in the system. And they're all, what I really admire about the Canucks goaltending system is that they're all kind of spaced out. Just a little bit in terms of age. So Cayley's already a little bit older coming in from college. He's 23. DiPietro's 20. Silov's the recent draft pick. He is 18 years old. So they're all going to be developing at different timelines. Thank
yes.
you. And so the guy that seems most natural to develop quicker coming out of college would be Cayley. But what if Michael DiPietro has
Well, right now Cayley's down in Kalamazoo, yes. and Bachman and Michael DiPietro are playing with the Utica Comets. Zane McIntyre has been the one who's been recalled. But you can't bank on any of those goalies over the next couple of years. You just can't at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Bick, where do you come out on here? On seeing Jacob Markstrom? I mean, obviously now he's on personal leave because of a family matter. It will rejoin the team, according to the organization, sometime on the road trip coming up, starting in St. Louis on Thursday. But seeing Thatcher Demko play, how important can he be to this organization?
Massive. In the same way we talk about how important the third and fourth line can be. Like, when you're a supplemental player, your biggest value is to provide rest for the star players. Yes, we want the Brandon Sutters of the world to put up 20 goals. That's kind of a luxury. The bigger value is don't get hemmed in. Don't you know, have terrible shot metrics, don't get a lot of goals against. Really, just be able to eat up time so you can trust Petey and Brock and Bo and all those guys to play a fresher 19 minutes, 18 minutes. Same thing, that same logic applies to Thatcher Demko. Can you take 27 starts, 30 starts? Like, that's a nice number. If he shows that he you can trust him for 30 games, 27 games, that means we get a fresher Jacob Markstrom for 57, 55, whatever the number becomes.
And once you get into the postseason, if you get into the postseason, all of a sudden your goalie is not worn down.
And we're talking like fractions of differences. Are we talking about a 9.14 save percentage or a 9.17 save percentage for Jacob Markstrom? But that little bit of difference has all the difference in the world, that if he's well above league average, suddenly the Canucks don't have to play 5-4 games. They can play 3-2 games, 2-3-1 games, whatever the difference is.
Or you can win different types of games.
Yes.
Like you saw against the Flyers, which was a lot different than the games we had seen leading up to that one. And I know the LA Kings are a different competition, yeah. But still, you need to be able to win close-checking games, physical games, fast-paced games. Do you have the ability to win those types of games?
Imagine that same game getting played out, the way the Flyers came on strong in the third period, like really started pushing it. But now you have a fatigued Jacob Markstrom, and that game is in January. It's if he's like he was obviously the first start of the game, looked fantastic, and if he's not perfectly fresh and everything's just a little bit slow, we're probably sitting here talking about how, all right, well, what's got to get fixed on the team, and they weren't really that strong, and the penalty kill, and he's all that gets mitigated because he was so strong.
Goaltending can cover up a lot for an organization, and we've seen this here in Vancouver in the past. The question, though, is, how much better is this defense overall, and how much easier does that make life on a goalie like Jacob Markstrom, who last season faced some of the highest degree of difficulty of any starting goalies in the National Hockey League? How much has that changed so far this season? Because through four games, the Canucks have been outchancing their opposition, which is something you did not see over four-game stretches last season from this Canucks squad, which is a lot different now. And a lot of it has to do with Quinn Hughes, of course, but Tyler Myers as well, who has been very good in all four games since signing with the Vancouver Canucks. And if he can play the way he's played so far, and let's say this is the best version of Tyler Myers, can he maintain the best version of himself? And how did he get here?
I think he can, because I think the coaching staff, again, are trying to put him in the position where they can get the best version of Tyler Myers, which is to say, keep him in the offensive zone and play him with good play-driving forwards. And so you often see Tyler Myers out there with Pettersson or with the Bo Horvat unit. And there has to be a responsibility from every five player on the ice, not including the goaltender, to make sure that they're involved in the play. And Tyler Myers right now is doing a lot of those good things where he's holding the puck at the blue line. He's pinching in when he needs to. I think yesterday he had a scoring chance that just unfortunately got saved, but he came in aggressively looking for the one-time pass, and he got the pass off. He was looking for the rebound. He had a chance on that too with his long reach. When you have a defenseman like him who's smart enough to understand when pinching is encouraged by the coaching staff, but also with that reach, able to maybe, shore up his own mistakes. Because there was one opportunity where, he uses his incredible reach and his long strides to really catch up and backcheck and take the puck away from the Flyers. Like, that's the Tyler Myers that you want to see. The Tyler Myers we don't want to see is, again, him being miscast as this big, heavy, physical, defensive type, where a lot of those mistakes that we see Tyler Myers on the end of, they come in on the defensive zone. He doesn't seem to make a lot of mistakes when you just have him in the offensive zone and he's able to make
smart passes. To get to the offensive zone, I mean, you don't just put your defenseman in the offensive zone. You have to be able to get there by giving them the green light. Tyler Myers has a green light. When he has the puck, you can pretty much do whatever you want. And you see that confidence in his game. The zone starts, that stuff matters to some degree, of course, but it's more about the transition game. And you put Edler and Myers together, and you tell Myers, you're an offensive defenseman. When you have the puck, you have free reign. You can skate it up, you can make plays. You don't have to just hit it off the boards and out. You don't have to worry too much about your defensive positioning. Be more focused on being the best version of yourself, and that is a confident, puck-moving, puck-rushing defenseman. And for a player who the Canucks wooed in the offseason, brought him into Vancouver, offered him a big contract, they made him feel like a star. And he walks into this locker room, and he feels like a star on a young team, and he feels comfortable, confident, And he's being told to play to the best of his ability.
Yeah.
Sometimes just allowing a player to be the best version of himself by saying, okay, this is what you're good at, you have the green light. You do your thing. You're on the power play as well. We're going to rely on you. And he's taken that, and he has stepped forward, and he's played really well through four games. Canucks Memesar on Twitter chimes in and says, do you guys think Markstrom's incredible play has just masked a lot of issues of the Canucks' fairly loose defense and taking one too many men on the ice penalties? They take too many of those. They have. Their line changes, something Travis Green does have to clean up. Yeah, there's been some defensive issues. But, Bick, you just took a look at the scoring chances, differentials, high danger ones, and those in general. And if you look at the rate so far this season through four games compared to last season, what are you seeing?
Yeah, it's about four high danger scoring chances a game.
Mm-hmm.
Expected goals, you know, another metric you can use, about 30%, or 0.3 rather, not 30%, 0.3, which is, again, encouraging signs that so far, again, four games, they're trending in a direction. They still have to create more, but as far as from where they were defensively, early indications are much improved, which is, I mean, don't necessarily need the numbers to tell you that. You can just watch the games. You can figure that out. It does look like.
It's when the eye test also matches the underlying numbers, right?
And you can kind of feel that they're not putting themselves in positions. Now, I don't necessarily know if that's because of defensive zone coverages or they're just spending less time in their own zone.
It's a bit of both.
It's probably a function of both.
Probably more of it is spending more time in the offensive zone.
Yeah.
Because when you see the Canucks spend too much time in their own zone, you can see them get running around. And even Tyler Myers, who we just talked about how good he is through the neutral zone in transition and holding the puck in the other end, when he has to run around and defend in his own zone and when his reach can't help him, he does get turned around every once in a while.
One thing that is kind of evident, though, is when there is a loose puck in the defensive zone and a Canucks player gets there first, it's at least four of the five guys can make plays to get out of the zone, which is a stark contrast to what we've seen in years past. There's a certain calmness now when players get the puck that they know how to, A, support each other for the other guy, find your support, and also just get out of the zone. It's been obvious that there's less time when guys are just running around looking for help and, you know, wind up turning the puck over. Even if they're capable players, in years past, like, there was a lot of turnovers in the Canucks' own zone.
What's encouraging about all that is, to the point, and I know Canucks memes are on Twitter, is not wrong about some defensive issues and some lapses. But they're already down compared to last season, at least through an early trend. And the Canucks haven't really still figured out their system. They're still not playing as well as they can.
Yep.
And to me, that is encouraging because you are seeing improvements already, and they should be nowhere near as good as they should be defensively and through their systems because they're still trying to figure that out. Something Travis Green himself talked about post-game on Saturday as well was we're still figuring out the system. The players are still trying to figure out the chemistry. Like, it's not all there. It's going to take another 10, 15 games, really, for this team to figure it out. But the encouraging sign is you are already seeing improvements systematically from what you saw last season.
Yeah, and I think, again, seeing the third pairing play more than what we saw in the first two games when they started on the road in Alberta, that's encouraging because, again, you want your guys to build on the chemistry, build on that timing like Travis Green's talking about. And in the case, what I'm encouraged, too, is that Jordy Benn has played really solidly. In the event that an Alex Edler injury does occur, Tyler Myers seemingly does have at least a good substitute partner with a guy like Jordy Benn maybe being able to move up in the lineup. If what you want out of Tyler Myers is for him to be the offensive guy, the green light guy, then he's going to need to play with someone that's a little bit more steady defensively and is willing to stay back. That does seem like Jordy Benn to a T right now. So it's good to see that, again, even in the dire situation that injuries happen, you're going to have that depth again coming up for you and working out, at least on paper. We have yet to see that in person, of course, but that's encouraging because in years past, if you had an injury to Alex Edler, you're talking about Derek Pouliot having to move up and play more minutes, and that just never seemed like it was going to work out, and of course, we know it didn't.
Another defenseman who might have a different reality soon. We're going to talk about this defenseman who's been a Vancouver Canuck for his whole career. Heading into this season, it looked like it would be the last year for him as a Vancouver Canuck. Has that reality changed? We'll discuss right here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
This is The Playbook with Satyar Shah and John Jang. United by sport, we are Sportsnet 650.
Besser on the left board for Henderson in the corner, banks it behind the goal, and rolls off the dasher to JT Miller. Right corner, now back to the line, tandem with a shot, take by Henderson, rebound, Besser scores! With his first of the year, 5:01 into the first, the Canucks take a 1-0 lead.
Monday, Turkey Thanksgiving edition of the Playbook. Going down memory lane. We're not doing throwback Monday, but if you have any requests today, they are welcome. We're thankful that you listen on Thanksgiving Monday here to the Playbook.
Yeah.
So if you have any requests, any questions, we will make this about you. So pay tribute to whoever you want. If you want to be thankful, there's a song that represents your thankfulness. Send in your submission. 650-650 Subway text line. You can hit up our producer, Bick Nazar, at Bick650 on Twitter. Let DJ Honey Brown know what records you want him to spin.
And remember, every Sunday from 12 to 1 p.m. down at the Fortune Sound Club, one of the hottest exclusive events in Vancouver every week. Only 5 people allowed in. Will it be you? You have a better chance of getting in that door if you send in a song request, too. So I don't always know where Bick is going with the underlying theme sometimes that he picks out with our song intros, but a little bit
he's
of
here to confuse you.
A little bit of Taylor Swift on the morning? That's
no,
all right.
I think I heard it in a commercial yesterday, and I was like, oh, yeah, that song.
See, I thought it was Jonas Brothers because they were just in town over the weekend.
Oh, I should have played Jonas Brothers. Might be.
It's all good. I'm pretty sure Taylor Swift ended up dating one of the Jonas Brothers, so... By association.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, that is your entertainment minute on the Playbook.
There you go.
Dating advice or dating recaps. Yes. I have no idea who dates who.
No, dating advice was Friday.
Oh yeah, you guys. Oh, I was not here on Friday. I heard about some dating conversations. What was that all about?
Well,
what's going on?
We didn't even spawn the conversation originally. It was something that Walker and Rintoul had on Thursday. Last Thursday is that... he was talking about how Andrew Walker admitted he professed, like, Boston Pizza is one of my favorite places in the world. Mm-hmm. I love it. You can't find a colder Coors Light anywhere. It's always at BP. But he did go on to say that if I'm taking a girl out on a first date, despite my love for BP, I'm never going to bring her to Boston Pizza. So then Scott and Cam had a really good counterpoint. Like, why are you hiding your true self? Like, if you really love Boston Pizza that much, it shouldn't matter where you take them. And maybe you should actually take them to the place that you love the most. Because if you really like the girl, you should show her more of yourself.
Yeah, but at the same time, is it not about being on your best behavior when you meet somebody first? Like, don't you show the best version of yourself? Yeah, you don't want to be deceitful and lie about who you are or cover things up. But you want to put your best foot forward, don't you?
Well,
the first impressions matter to a great degree. Like, let's say you're lazy or let's say you're a bit of a slob. Don't you want to try to rectify that to some degree? Or, you know,
I'm too lazy to do it.
But that's the thing. Like, what if you just want to find someone who's also lazy and slob-like? And thus you can be lazy and slobby together.
Well, I mean, I'd say do whatever you want that makes you happy, but that's probably not good for your health, and you should aim a little bit higher, have a bit more self-respect, right? I mean, don't you want, if you're with somebody, you want somebody that cares about themselves, right?
Well, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was just, it got into like a very passionate debate amongst the three of us, so it was Big Jamie and I, and we were just going on about it. Maybe I'm a little biased on the whole, simply because it was Boston Pizza, because I worked there for 3 years, and I've actually seen plenty of people going on first dates at Boston Pizza. Now, were they of the same age that Andrew Walker is, 30 plus? No.
By the way, you know what one of my favorite dishes at Boston Pizza used to be? They don't make it anymore, but every once in a while I ask to get it off menu.
They don't make it anymore. Huh?
No.
I got to think about this one for a second.
It involves pierogi.
Oh, the spicy pierogi pizza?
No.
Oh.
Pierogi stromboli. Remember that?
Oh, no. I actually don't remember
that.
See,
you used to work there, and I know more. Come on, man. Well, come on, John.
Well, I don't know if you know more.
I don't know more. I know more about that one.
But I know people do love that pierogi pizza. Yeah.
Pierogies are good in general.
That is a very good point.
Yes.
We can agree to that. Yes. With a little bit of bacon. Some caramelized onions, yeah, always very good.
Yes,
now but you're
John,
hungry for Thanksgiving.
Sorry.
So here's the thing: like, let's say you sign with a new team. Do you want to show your flaws right away, or do you want to put your best foot forward? Like, if you're Tyler Myers, do you say, you know what, this is my first few games with the Canucks. I'm bad in the defensive zone, so let me play more in the defensive zone and make more mistakes, so you know what I'm bad at, as opposed to me doing what I'm good at.
Well, it'd be kind of refreshing to see just a player who's being brutally honest. It's like, I don't want to play defense.
But that's how I view that. You know what I mean? So I view it as, if you get added as a new player to a new team, you're probably trying to do the best. You know you have flaws, and yes, people are going to find out about your flaws, but you do your best to hide the flaws as much as you can.
Fair.
And that's when I look at Tyler Myers, for instance, and it goes back to confidence. Because I do believe for a player like Tyler Myers, and I don't think he would ever admit to this, But I do believe there was a level of frustration in Winnipeg about how he was used, about how he was put in a position to not be the best version of himself. And sometimes getting a player who has some talent, obviously, and is able and capable, and you put him in a position to show him confidence, it can happen. Now, there always has to be a baseline, because we say this about young guys as well, right? And the conversation would go around a player like Ben Hutton in the past, and it's like, well, you know, Ben's a young player, put him in a position to have success, but you have to show a certain baseline of competency to be put in a position where you can have success. And Tyler Myers is a competent defenseman. Was he a number 4 or 5 when the Canucks signed him? That was the argument. That was the conversation. Is he a number 4? Is he a number 5 defenseman? Well, so far through 4 games, he's shown he's better than that. Yep. Can he keep it going for the rest of the season? That remains to be seen. But what I like about him and what I like about what I've seen from him is he is flourishing because he's allowed to be the best version of himself. And that is what we always look to find out about players. What is the best version of you and what can you do as an individual player?
I think it also works out really well that the system that Travis Green and Nolan Baumgartner want to put in place actually accentuate Tyler Myers' strong skills, his best qualities, him wanting to get involved in the transition game, a defenseman that wants to make those pinches when available. It's simply that in the past number of years, Travis Green didn't have the personnel necessary to carry on that system. But now, on the three pairings, they all offer at least one defenseman on that pairing that can move the puck up and stay active on the play. That's Tyler Myers with Alex Edler. That's Quinn Hughes with Chris Tanev. That's Troy Stetcher with Jordy Benn. Now, anytime you throw a pairing out there, you don't have to worry about, oh, God, like our system's going to crumble here because they don't have the skills necessary. So to your point about hitting the baseline, Tyler Myers hits that baseline and then brings a little bit of the extra, because the extra is that when he does make a mistake, he can use that long reach to sometimes, not every time, but every now and then, bail himself out of trouble because he can just bring the puck back. That's kind of the benefit of being like 6'8" or however tall he is.
It goes both ways. His ability to recover because of his reach is very positive, and you see it happen. But at times, you can also see him be a bit clumsy. The puck gets lost in his feet, especially on the forecheck around the board sometimes, because guys have more leverage being a little bit smaller. They can get inside him a little bit, and they can take the puck away from him from time. So he does get turnstiled a bit in his own zone because of how long and big he is. But he is playing to the best of his ability, and that's refreshing to see. And he's not the only veteran defenseman on this team who is playing to the best of his ability, because the other one, who all of a sudden might have a different reality in a longer-term future in Vancouver, is Chris Tanev. And Elliot Friedman on Hockey Night in Canada over the weekend mentioned, before the season began, the sentiment was Chris Tanev's final year in Vancouver. We talked about this, how that looks to be very possible. But because of how he's looked early in the season, because of him being reinvigorated and this team feeling a bit different about his chances of being competitive, maybe, just maybe, Chris Tanev is here to stay a bit longer than just this season.
I'd be okay with that, as long as the money makes sense.
It all depends on the contract, you're right.
Because if it's a similar to what Alex Edler signed, 2 years, not a lot of commitment to a guy that we know has injury concern and for the past number of seasons had been on the decline with the underlying numbers about how well he can defend in his own zone. But you're right. I do think Quinn Hughes is the ultimate factor in what's happening with Chris Tanev. But you shouldn't discount what Chris Tanev is bringing to the table, because if you ask Quinn Hughes how much he's enjoyed playing with Chris Tanev, he's kind of over the moon about it. It's nice when you're a young 20-year-old defenseman, a rookie playing your first few games in the NHL, to have someone as experienced and as cool and as calm as Chris Tanev. The one thing about Tanev that we always knew, the guy has ice in his veins, so he never really gets rattled, never really buckles under pressure. That's kind of the perfect sort of symmetry you want to have with a rookie defenseman, someone who's really raw and still working out the finer details of playing in the NHL. Again, I'm okay with bringing Chris Tanev back, because it seems like with Quinn Hughes, I said it before and I'll say it, this is the year we can be cautiously optimistic that Chris Tanev can stay healthier. Because when you are actually keeping the puck in the offensive zone, and when you are avoiding the number of the hits that Chris Tanev used to take in his own defensive zone, in the corners, battling for those pucks, that's what got him into trouble. But now you're playing with Quinn, and you're playing with guys like Pettersson, Bo Horvat, units that are driving play. The risk of injury is slowly getting mitigated game by game. Of course, he's still going to block shots. He ended up blocking 4 of them late in the game on Saturday, too. But that's something you'll never take away from him. Chris Tanev is going to be the fearless guy who blocks shots. I just want to see him avoid those big hits. And so far, playing with Quinn Hughes has seemingly done that.
It's still so early in the season that I'd be very, very careful with whatever contract negotiation I have with Chris Tanev. Yeah, it's great that he looks good right now early in the season. He's reinvigorated. He's healthy. The Canucks are playing better as a team. Let's see how the season goes. Right? Have we not seen the story before with Chris Tanev? And I love what I've seen, and I'm happy with his play, and he is happier, and he talked about himself, and Ian McIntyre talked about this extensively.
Mm.
He hasn't been this excited to play hockey, maybe ever, with the Canucks. He feels like this team has a chance. He loves playing with Quinn Hughes, and I'm on board with all that. But this guy hasn't played over 70 games in forever.
Yeah.
Let's see how the season goes. Let's see how healthy he can be. Let's see what the best version of Chris Tanev looks like in the second half of the season. And if you're feeling good about it then, and you want to go, say, a short-term extension, like the one to give Edler, for instance, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, something along those lines, let's have that conversation.
Yeah.
But let's see a lot more than just four games, and let's see how healthy Chris Tanev can be before you go down the road of signing him to an extension. Because the last thing you want is to him to revert back to getting hurt again,
yeah,
regardless of the reasoning for it, and you have another player on a long-term deal that can't stay healthy for a full season. I want to see it consistently for the full year, or at least for the majority of the year, John, before I feel comfortable giving Chris Tanev a contract extension.
And also, I think we have to be very prudent and open-minded about how the young players in the system are going to be playing and progressing, because if Jet Wu puts on a really strong season this year for Moose Jaw in his final season and looks the part of being ready to take on an NHL or a full-time professional role next year, you have to be prudent because, yes, you might want to keep Chris Tanev, but what have we said here is that the Canucks moving forward need to add young, cheap, inexpensive defensemen or players up front that can provide the depth without having to spend more than $1 million on each player, because eventually the Elias Pettersson extension will come. And the same way as Quinn Hughes' extension will come. And giving yourself more of that wiggle room is going to be so critical for this team. And
in many ways, yeah, the decision to give an extension will be between Troy Stetcher and Chris Tanev. Because if you're looking at how much money they want to spend on the back end, and they have to pay Quinn Hughes in a couple of years, it's unlikely they're giving Chris Tanev a multi-year deal, let's say 3-year contract, and giving Troy Stetcher a 3-4-year deal.
Right.
So it's going to come down to one of those two players. This is my belief, and I'm not saying the Canucks are going to go out there and trade Stetcher today, although I do believe they're far more open to the idea of trading Troy Stetcher right now than they've ever been. And given the right deal, they could make that happen. But the Tanev extension essentially is between Tanev and Stetcher, and this year, the next 6 months, will tell us a lot about which player will end up staying here long term. JCast chimes into our 650-650 Subway text line. Based on management's philosophy, Tanev isn't getting traded because we need to make the playoffs, and Benning can probably re-sign him at a good term and price. Remember the surprisingly good deal for Edler. What the contract looks like will determine how I feel about it. But I just say, yeah, you want to be open to it, Tanev's extension, great. But let's see him be healthy for longer than four games. Let's see him be healthy and play more than 60 games,
sure,
before feeling confident that he's a guy you can rely on to be healthier on a different team when he gets into his 30s, because he hasn't shown it so far in his career.
And if Troy Stetcher ends up winning the season-long battle over which defenseman should earn, you know, an extension and has the right to stay in Vancouver, at least for one funky shift on Saturday, we did see what a Stetcher and Quinn Hughes pairing could look like. Now, they weren't actually playing. They weren't supposed to be playing together.
It was a shift after a PK.
Exactly. And you know what? It was kind of fun. They were holding the puck in. Quinn Hughes and Troy Stetcher really read off one another quite well, led to a scoring chance, and they were cycling. They were giving and going. There was a lot of fun there. Of course, the only limitation to that pairing is the physical one and how willing is the coaching staff going to be putting a possible pairing of Troy Stetcher and Quinn Hughes together when you still play in a division that has big physical teams like Anaheim, like LA still, and, you know, Edmonton's no slouch. It's not like they are all just Connor McDavid's. They've got a lot of size on that lineup as well. Apart from that, it was actually really fun to see two of your youngest, most dynamic defensemen kind of working and being able to think together on the ice.
You notice how much more zone time you can have when you have defensemen to get you into the offensive zone?
Huge.
And find ways to keep the puck in the offensive zone? That shift you talk about, maybe the most impressive thing that Hughes and Stetcher did together was keep the puck in. There was a number of different times where it looked like the puck was going to get out. Stetcher was able to hold it in.
Yeah.
Quinn Hughes was able to hold it in. Their rotations and their skating was fantastic. It's so amazing to see what a mobile defense can do for you. And if you're looking at why this Canucks team could be better than last year, it all goes back to that defense. But the next question really comes down to, you look at what happened with the top six. Of the core positions so far on this team, and when I say core, I mean top six forwards, third line center, which I think is a core piece, and top four defensemen and goalies. What core piece or what core part of this team doesn't have to be a player necessarily. It could just be that position. You can mention, say, the sixth forward. You can mention the third line. You can mention who should be riding with the top line. Mm-hmm. Goaltender, top four defense. Which core position is the one we need to see more improvement from?
I do think it's the third line center.
Yeah.
Because I think that has the room for the most possible growth, especially if you're like me and you feel like Adam Gaudette is now the third line center moving forward. Because I like Brandon Sutter. But we know Brandon Sutter is limited, and I've been trying to maybe not defend Brandon Sutter, but sort of highlight his good points. So when he is healthy, like, we know he can skate. We know he's a good defender. We know he's an asset on the penalty kill. He's good at face-offs. Like, there's a lot of things that Brandon Sutter can bring to the table. But Adam Gaudette, if we are truly believing and have hopes that he can be the third-line center moving forward, he's going to have to eventually earn those details that Brandon Sutter has already earmarked to his game. Can Adam Gaudette be a penalty killer eventually? Can Adam Gaudette be a 20-goal scorer eventually like Brandon Sutter was? Can Adam Gaudette win faceoffs more than he loses them? Can he actually improve his skating? Like, there's so much that we have yet to see from Adam Gaudette, and he's only 23, that if he starts taking that next step to his development and the coaching staff begins to, you know, just acquire a little bit more trust in him and a bit more confidence in his play, I think Adam Gaudette could be maybe a better version of Brandon Sutter. And I don't say that lightly, because I know Brandon Sutter is a really well-accomplished veteran in this game, and I know tons of people in the hockey world love him. But that's where the growth to me seems the most possible, because whatever happens with the top six, whatever happens with the defense, I'm not sure anything really represents the biggest opportunity of growth as Adam Gaudette moving forward. And Quinn Hughes is going to be excellent, but I'm not really counting on Quinn Hughes to be needing more. Like, we're going to see Quinn Hughes already become a star.
See, I disagree with that. I'd say Quinn Hughes is the player, and Elias Pettersson still, that can give a lot more, because their ceiling is so much higher. Adam Gaudette has a high ceiling, and I like him a lot. And yes, he's shown some positives so far, and has a longer way to go. And I understand your point. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Quinn Hughes has the potential to be a number one defenseman.
No, you're right.
And Pettersson has the potential to be, like, a bonafide franchise number one center, for instance. And what is Adam Gaudette's ceiling? And I want to put one on him.
Sure.
At the very best, maybe a second.
Yep. I would say
second line center.
If
everything really kind of hits, but usually probably something down as a third liner. But I do agree that that position is going to be the one to keep a very, very close eye on, especially with how Travis Green wants to use his lines. Mm. Because if, say, Sutter struggles at times and Gaudette struggles at times, guess what line played fairly well the other night?
The Virtanen line. I call it the Virtanen line because he was just the most noticeable.
Jay Beagle and Tim Schaller. And give Tim Schaller credit for playing a lot better to start this season.
Yeah.
So right now, depending on the game, whichever line is going to be going is the one that's going to be getting the matchups and more ice time. And for now, that works. But one of those two lines has to figure it out. And can Gaudette and Sutter hold down the third line, or will it end up being Beagle that holds down that third line? To me, that's the biggest question mark. Yes, the sixth forward still remains to, is waiting for somebody to seize the opportunity. Josh Lebo's there right now. Michael Ferland, who we will talk about, has been struggling out of the gate. Antoine Roussel will come back. Where does he kind of put himself in the conversation of the middle six and who gets into, say, that sixth forward spot and how much influx will it be all year? But to me, that third line center position and which center can give you the steadiest minutes is the biggest question mark for me.
And it matters too, because we know in the playoffs when the games really start tightening down, the whistles kind of get put away. And look at me talking about the playoffs with the Vancouver Canucks four games in. But this is because I'm looking at the career of Adam Gaudette as a whole. And assuming the Canucks will be a playoff team during his career here, the third line center is often very pivotal. Matchup purposes, physical purposes, where, you know, we heard the saying with the St. Louis Blues last season, you know, there are certain guys that can take you to the playoffs, and then there are certain players that will get you through the playoffs. And that was kind of the Pat Maroon thing. And I know Pat Maroon's not a center, but my only point being, there needs to be someone who obviously has a baseline level of skill so that he can pop in the odd goal and point every now and then, but is capable of being snarly. He's capable of playing down low and heavy hockey. The kind
that's
of hockey
also
that
why they brought
loves.
In Miller in. That's why they brought Michael Ferland in. And
but those guys are also expected, well, maybe not so much with Ferland right now, but they are expected to be contributors offensively. Whereas Adam Gaudette might maybe at his best version, whenever that might be in a few years from now, the biggest expectation out of Adam Gaudette will be play heavy hockey so that you give your best players, Pettersson and Bo Horvat and JT Miller and Brock Besser, those key shifts off where they can rest and recuperate. And as Bick was sort of saying earlier this morning, have them more fresh down the road when the second half of the season is kicking.
The only thing I'd caution is don't expect Adam Gaudette to be this physical force as a center. He has an ability to be a good two-way guy. He can play big boy hockey. He can play hard.
Yeah.
But don't expect him to go out and knock heads like a Patrick
Maroon. Think of it more like Ryan Kessler because...
Well, he's not Kessler.
No, I know, but...
like Ryan Kessler was one of the best skaters in the NHL.
I know.
And one of the best agitators in the NHL
That's the thing.
And he had it early. Now, don't forget, like, Ryan Kessler had that when he came in as a teenager.
I understand, but don't forget, Adam Gaudette was also a bit of a chirper in college.
No, listen, I appreciate that, but... Yeah. Ryan Kessler at his in his heyday
he's
a Selke
trophy.
Power center, man. Remember the Nashville Predator series?
Oh, of course.
I'm saying is, and I like Adam Gaudette. I have a lot of time for Adam Gaudette, and I want him to develop, and I believe in him a lot. But let's just be careful with, like, he's not a Ryan Kessler guy. He doesn't skate that way. He's not as physical as him. He's not going to be as much of an agitator. Ryan Kessler was a Selke winning two-way centerman.
40 goals.
Yeah. You know, 40 goals with a one-year outlier
year.
Yeah. And I like a lot of Adam Gaudette's game. Expecting him to play like Ryan Kessler might be asking
a bit
too
much. Poor man's version. You know, like, can you be at least
I get what you're
to
saying.
A level
All
of
I'm
effectiveness
saying is
to
just
that
be careful what you expect
right.
from a guy like Adam Gaudette. And I like his potential as well.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when we put that up and say, you know, he can be like Ryan Kessler, sometimes we forget how good Ryan Kessler was.
It's the impact that I think Adam Gaudette could eventually have once we see the best version, the fully developed final version of an Adam Gaudette. You know, what is that going to look like? And so far, it's encouraging that at least in one summer from last year to this year, he's already grown this much. And we don't look at him and being like, maybe he doesn't belong. He's adamantly proven to me already that he's an NHLer. Now he's still trying to figure out the finer details to become the best third-line version of himself.
Still a long way to
go.
But some promising moments from him so far. We will talk a lot more hockey and Canucks as the show goes on. We'll give you the latest on Jacob Markstrom's situation. He is leaving the team temporarily for personal reasons to attend a family matter. So that means Thatcher Demko, Zane McIntyre are your two goalies. And we'll talk some NFL. Yes, the Cleveland Browns suck. The Seattle Seahawks, 5-1. And what about the MVP race? Did we see a monumental change in who should be the MVP? We'll discuss right here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
The Playbook with Satyar Shah and John Jang on Sportsnet 650. So Wilson hit as he throws for the end zone. Catch made! Jerron Brown, a Seahawks touchdown. Wilson was never able to see it as they celebrate Seattle style.
Wave bye-bye to those Cleveland Browns. That is what the Seattle Seahawks did. And that was the dance they had in sync. Is the song called Bye Bye Too? Is that what it's called?
Of course.
Bye Bye Bye.
Bye Bye Bye. I know the song.
Don't pretend like you don't know the dance moves.
No, I know the dance moves.
Wait, I missed it.
What?
I messed it up. Just mixed up the lyrics. I was singing along.
I think you had it.
Bye Bye Bye. Just another pawn in this game for two.
What'd you say?
I had just another game for this pawn of two. Yeah.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense. John, get it together.
That's an illegal chess move.
Yeah. Good point. I know you didn't like the dance so much, but you got to give credit to the Seahawks.
No, who said I don't like the dance?
Well, because it was against your brand.
I can like the dance. I don't like. You know what I didn't like was my Cleveland Browns playing like absolute.
Bye, bye, bye.
They play like crap. They deserve everything. Any criticism you have for the Browns, they deserve it. Any criticism for that football game, go ahead. Have at it. You know what? What the best way of not getting pissed off at celebrations is? Don't allow touchdowns.
Prevent them.
How often do I sit here and talk about I like these celebrations? Yeah, give them credit. And I'll give the Seahawks credit when it comes to their dance moves and their coordinated dance celebrations.
They're the best.
Post-touchdowns. Yeah. They do a good job.
Power rankings number one for that.
They're up there. I mean, Seahawks fans think everything is the best with the Seahawks. You guys are always like, oh, best coach, best quarterback, best this, best that.
Ask Bick. I think the Seahawks are the best touchdown celebrating team in the league.
I don't know about that necessarily.
I mean, don't forget there was the step over. There was the whole, like, bah.
I've seen some good ones. I've seen the Vikings have some good ones, too.
There was a race yesterday. Was it the Vikings?
Yeah, Vikings are always
that was the race.
Yeah.
That was nice.
Yeah. Giving them credit.
I mean, these guys are pretty creative.
Yeah. But everything's not the best just because the Seahawks do good things.
That's not what I'm saying.
It's always like, Seahawks, the best.
Everything's
the best.
No.
Best dance, best this, best that.
Well, I'm not going to say it.
Well, what I can tell you, though, is the Browns are not the worst in the NFL.
That is very true.
But they're very close. They're very close to being, yeah. So we're going to have some fun with something coming up a bit later on. We're going to talk about we're going to do some power rankings a bit later with the NFL as well. We'll talk about the top 10, 12 teams, who are the contenders, and we'll kind of break down the strength of the AFC / NFC as well. And the New England Patriots remain undefeated at 6-0. Those Kansas City Chiefs have lost back-to-back games at home, no less. Patrick Mahomes looks a bit banged up. A lot of different angles to look at when it comes to the NFL, and we're going to have some fun with what's been the biggest turkey in the NFL so far.
Gobble, gobble.
And I don't mean that in an endearing way. We've been saying positive things about Thanksgiving because we're thankful for a lot, and we're thankful for doing this job on a daily basis. We're thankful to have you listen to us blabber about sports on a daily basis, and a lot more to be thankful for living in a great country like Canada and living in North America in a free country like the way we do. But on a more, say, negative side, who's been the NFL's biggest turkey?
Gobble,
it can be a team, it can be a coach, it can be a player, it can be anything you want it to be. The biggest turkey so far in the NFL.
Yeah.
We'll have some fun with that as well.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of great candidates. There might be one in Cleveland. There could be one who doesn't have a job. I mean, there's a lot of great turkeys. That's the thing about the NFL. There's turkeys like every week. So it's easy to just like go down to the farm and pick out which turkey you want to choose for that.
But there are turkeys that are more ripe than others.
Absolutely.
So make sure you choose the correct turkey. Bobby chimes into our Subway text line, 650-650. Lamar Jackson for MVP. All you Seahawks fans will finally get to see him firsthand next week.
Yes. Yeah, I got to admit, that's
going to be
scary.
A lot of fun.
That's a little scary.
But the MVP conversation, with the way Patrick Mahomes started the season, the first four games, I was like, well, he's running away with it. And he's still been okay the last couple of games. By his standards, he hasn't been good enough. They've lost back-to-back games. He hurt his ankle. It doesn't look like he has the same ability to get out of the pocket and make those plays like we've seen him make throughout the season. But the MVP conversation is now at least 3, 4, 5 deep. And it's not as simple as saying Mahomes should get it no matter what.
Yeah, no. Russell Wilson probably is, and
you can easily make the case he's the leader.
On the heel of you saying like Seattle should be the best at everything, or at least me saying that.
I'm Russell joking Wilson, around about that, but it's like, you know, it is kind of funny because, you know, fans of their home team will always be like, we're the best at celebrating.
But I don't think I'm being too silly when I say Russell Wilson is right now the clear-cut favorite for the MVP. If you're giving it right now today, Russell Wilson wins it hands down.
I don't know, hands down is probably a bit strong. You still have to look at what a guy like Deshaun Watson is doing as well. You have to look at Patrick Mahomes. Like, it's close. All three of those guys are, to me, right there. You can make a case for Russell Wilson number one easily. Yep. Make a case. I just wouldn't say hands down.
I have it, if I had to give you four, Russell Wilson, Deshaun Watson, Patrick Mahomes, Christian McCaffrey. And that's an elite group of players that we know are just excellent right now. McCaffrey, what he's been doing for the Panthers is just a revelation. And I think we've always seen it coming. Like, McCaffrey revolutionized the playbook there in Carolina in his first year, and he's just only gotten better and stronger, more diverse somehow over the past three seasons. But right now, Russell Wilson just... Let me put it this way. When it seems like the offensive line is actually worse on a given week because of injuries. So this past weekend against Cleveland, up against Myles Garrett, up against Ogun, they have no Dwayne Brown. They have no Fluker. And yet they still managed to pull out a really good performance in terms of protecting Russell Wilson. And a large part of that is because Russell Wilson, I think he understands the situation and the circumstances that he's put into. Maybe to a fault, because when it seems like he has a better offensive line, like we saw last year, like his sack rate actually went up. But when he has less of, like, you know, viable protection, at least according to the metrics, he somehow is more efficient, and he manages to avoid the sacks. So he's a magician. I can't think of any other titles to call Russell Wilson anymore. He just finds a way to get it done, even when it seems like the stakes are so high against a team that can obviously attack the quarterback like Cleveland can. Russell Wilson, man, wizardry. That's why he's my number one MVP.
Let's bring in Danny Kelly into the conversation. Follow him on Twitter at Danny B. Kelly, courtesy of the Ringers NFL coverage. Also, check out the Dantasy Fantasy Podcast with Danny Hyphens on the Ringer as well. Danny, how about them Seattle Seahawks that are 5-1 on the season? You can thank my Cleveland Browns for essentially giving you that victory last night, yesterday.
Yeah, that was a weird game, huh?
It ever?
It felt like at times neither team wanted to win. But yeah, I mean, I guess the Seahawks got to feel good coming away with a victory on the road, especially after that start that they got off to. I think they were down 20-6 at one point in the first half, and it just did not look good for a while. But credit to the Seahawks for kind of sticking with it. The defense made some stops when it really needed to. And so, yeah, it was kind of the tale of two halves. The Seahawks definitely played better in the second half than in the first half.
Well, and sticking with the Seahawks for a second as well, and just looking at what Russell Wilson has been accomplishing, is it a stretch to say this is peak Russell Wilson? This might be the best we've ever seen him?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, he has not turned the ball over through the air. I don't remember if he has any fumbles this year, but no interceptions. He's just been really, really dialed in. Saw a couple stats today. One of them was, I don't remember the exact stat, but basically he's completing passes over expectation more than any other quarterback in the NFL. In other words, he's been so accurate down the field. The statistics can't even really explain how he's completing some of these passes, in other words. So, yeah, he's been really, really good. And like you guys were talking about, he's making a lot of plays out of structure. I think that just kind of – he's almost just defying convention of how quarterbacks can operate, because a lot of teams want their quarterbacks to operate within structure and be very on time and all this stuff. You know, obviously like the Peyton Mannings of the world, where everything's on time, you hit your back foot, the ball's out. And Russell Wilson kind of just plays, you know, not like – he's not like a sandlot quarterback all the time, but he's so in tune and so good at being able to make plays out of structure that it's become a huge, huge part of their offense. And for whatever reason, he's able to make that work consistently, which very, very few quarterbacks can do. So, yeah, I think he's just playing really, really high level right now. He's kind of seeing the field better than he's ever seen it. And it's, you know, that's the reason, I think, big reason the Seahawks are 5-1.
Well, and Danny, that whole notion of establishing the run is probably a bit overrated, because the numbers kind of show it's not necessarily needed to have a good passing game. But we saw Russell Wilson at his best when he had Marshawn Lynch, and now you have Chris Carson playing this way, and it does go hand in hand to some degree.
Yeah, I think the thing that I like about the Seahawks offense is, you know, I think everybody complains and rails about the Seahawks running too often, and I think that there's some legitimacy to that, of course, but the way that they can pair the run game with the passing attack, and especially a deep passing attack, it just makes the defense defend more of the field. If you have balance, if you're running the ball, that draws the defense up towards the line of scrimmage a little bit more than if you can throw the ball over their heads. It just makes them defend more green, if that makes any sense. So I think that when it's working correctly and when it's working well, when the Seahawks are able to run the ball, they're very, very hard to stop, but that needs – the key component there is that they can run the ball well. Like, if they're not running the ball well, it kind of annoys me when they don't go away from it and pass the ball more. But when they can run the ball really well, like we saw yesterday, it just makes them really, really hard to stop. Chris Carson is amazing, amazing running back. I'm completely back on the Carson bandwagon. He had a couple fumbles there. He's just really, really fun to watch. He makes people miss in the open field. He's just on fire right now.
Well, when the Seahawks do decide to throw, they need playmakers, and they've got plenty of it right now, it seems. Tyler Lockett has been dependable as always. But what about the growth of DK Metcalf from week one to where we're seeing DK Metcalf get involved on play action crossing routes? And that's just kind of the one small example of how he's managing to grow here week by week.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at his route tree from the first couple weeks, it was literally just go routes up the left side, up the left side of the field. And, you know, that makes sense. That's exactly what he did in college. The Seahawks didn't ask him to do too much right out the gate. But like you said, they're getting him more involved in different routes. They had what it might have been sort of like a side adjustment based on the coverage, where Russell Wilson just hit him with a quick slant to the left side of the field on a third down to pick up a first down. Plays like that where he can use his size and physicality. I mean, you see him, he just bodies people in the open field. He's like a power forward out there. It's like Barkley, you know, getting into the paint or something like that, because he's just so much stronger and so much bigger than most of the defensive backs that are covering him. So they've been able to use that to their advantage, and he's picking up yards after the catch. He still has the drag racer acceleration that makes him so dangerous down the field on play action, but yeah, they're getting him involved in more ways. He's not just a one-dimensional deep threat anymore, so that's really good to see. I mean, his strides early on in the season are really, really promising. Basically, very few rookie receivers kind of doing what he's doing, so that's very, very promising for his long-term future.
Elsewhere in the NFC West, 49ers, Rams, that game, your biggest takeaway, is it a confirmation that the 49ers are really this good or that the Rams are actually really this bad?
I lean towards the 49ers just being that good. I mean, we've seen the Rams put up like 500 plus yards and a bunch of points in previous games. Obviously, they've done a lot of that in garbage time, but the 49ers completely shut down the Rams. I mean, they just Jared Goff threw for 78 yards. I mean, it was just absolutely incredible what they were able to do defensively. I think that the 49ers are contending with the Patriots for the best defense in the NFL. It's certainly one of the most, if not the most improved unit in the NFL this season. You know, just what they've been able to do, D Ford, and you know, the rookie defensive end, Bosa, has just been incredible. DeForest Buckner is an amazing and underrated defensive lineman. Eric Armstead's still there. Solomon Thomas, I believe, even had a sack that yesterday. And so they've just been able to take, you know, accumulate talent over the last few years, and it's finally coming together. They've got two really good linebackers. They've got really, you know, a secondary that's playing out of its mind right now. You know, with what they're able to do, kind of controlling the ball, on the offensive side of the ball, this team really kind of reminds you of the early 2011, 2012 49ers teams that were just so tough and physical and run the ball and do all that. I think this is kind of a throwback to that era of the 49ers football, and it's really exciting because, you know, it's I'm looking forward to the Seahawks playing the 49ers again and having that be a big rivalry game, because this team looks legitimate to me.
Well, they look really good, a lot better than I anticipated they would look so far in the season. And that defense through five games, historically good. I mean, the numbers they're putting up is historically good through five games. So this might be, even if they don't do this for the entire season, they have a really high-end defense that is keeping them in a lot of games. Now, the game we looked most forward to watching this weekend was a potential MVP showdown between two of the most talented and exciting quarterbacks in the NFL, Patrick Mahomes and his Chiefs against Deshaun Watson and the Texans. And now the Chiefs have lost back-to-back games, and lo and behold, Patrick Mahomes doesn't look like a god. He looks like a demigod. But what does that kind of tell us about that entire team right now? I mean, you don't see Andy Reid lose back-to-back games first time since 2013 when he became the head coach of Kansas City. How concerning is this kind of trend here?
I think it is concerning. I mean, you know, I think number one, the Mahomes kind of tweaking his ankle again. It's kind of happened in multiple games now. It's definitely a concern. His numbers have really fallen off when he's had those, been hobbled by that injury. I think he had something like 40 something passing yards in the second half total, which is a low for him in his career. And so, it's certainly concerning. I think that the Texans did an amazing job of kind of taking the ball out of his hands. They possessed the football for 39 minutes compared to 20 minutes for the Chiefs, so nearly double the time of possession of the Chiefs, which, you know, it's just a great strategy if you can do it. They ran the ball. They strung together a bunch of really long drives, just kind of like, you know, bleed the clock down and can possess the football and keep it out of his hands. I want to say they only had three possessions in the second half. So the Chiefs, I mean, and so, I mean, that's exactly what you want to do. That's exactly how you can stop, you know, the guy that's been the best quarterback in football last year. And so, there's a blueprint of sorts, I guess, to beat the Chiefs this year, and that's just to grind the clock out and run the ball and keep the ball out of Mahomes' hands. And two teams are able to do that in two straight weeks. So, you know, I think you look at the Chiefs' defense as like a very big potential liability. They just can't get off the field this year, especially in the last 2 weeks. And so, yeah, that's definitely a concern going forward. If teams can continue to run the ball and you know, possess the football, that's a problem.
When on the flip side, you look at what Deshaun Watson's been able to do as a quarterback, and yesterday his numbers could look a lot better if, you know, Fuller and DeAndre Hopkins didn't have a few drops. So if you look at the way Deshaun Watson is playing with that offense, the number of weapons they have for him now, and when they start clicking, I mean, how do you stop that offense?
Yeah. I mean, if Will Fuller, I think Will Fuller had three touchdowns.
Yeah.
One of them, barely a drop. It was more like he could have had it and he just barely missed it. And then the other two were like definite drops. And so, you know, kind of Fuller had a chance to completely go off again this week and just didn't come up with a couple footballs. That certainly hurt the bottom line. But I think what we saw in this game was Watson is able to do things in so many different ways. I mean, his passing numbers weren't great, but he made up for it by rushing 10 times for 42 yards with 2 touchdowns. He can just beat you in so many different ways. He got his running backs a little bit more involved in the passing game, so that was good to see. You know, he's just spreading the ball around to all his playmakers. I mean, for of all people, Darren Fells has become like a threat, the 33-year-old Darren Fells. They're sort of their number two tight end. I think the guy came into the season looking like the number four tight end, and all of a sudden he's stringing together a couple of good games. The crazy thing, like you kind of alluded to there, they're not even really firing all cylinders yet. DeAndre Hopkins hasn't had a big game since week one, and that's, to me, they're just leaving a lot of meat on the bone. And when they can really kind of put it all together, when Will Fuller and Hopkins are both going off, I mean, this offense has potential to be, you know, Chiefs esque at its peak, like really, really unstoppable. So I'm looking forward to, hopefully that'll come together soon. I'm looking forward to watching that. This team is really, really fun to watch.
Well, Bick was making a really good point off air about how we're seeing the top receivers in the game be doubled so much now, and whether it is DeAndre Hopkins not having the year we thought, at least early on so far. You look at Odell Beckham and how he's being held in check, Julio Jones. Are we seeing a trend here with how to slow down, at the very least, the top receivers in the game?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a great point, and I think what will happen is it's going to make your number two receiver that much more important. Teams are going to need number two receivers that can really be playing. In theory, the Texans have that guy in Will Fuller. We saw what he could do last week when he had 3 touchdowns. I think he had like 200-plus yards receiving and 3 touchdowns, had an opportunity for 2 more touchdowns. He came down on the 1-yard line on 2 times. So, in theory, he could have had 5 touchdowns last week. He should have had 3 touchdowns this week. And so, in theory, Fuller is that person or two that can really take advantage of teams double-teaming Hopkins. And if he can put any semblance of consistency together, it's going to make teams really question whether they should continue to double-team Hopkins. I mean, and when it comes to, like, you know, the Browns, I don't think they have a real number two at this point. I think Jarvis Landry is more of like a slot receiver on the underneath type thing. Antonio Callaway has not been very good. He's just been really, really inconsistent. Rashard Higgins has been hurt. With the Falcons, I think Calvin Ridley is that guy that they want him to be, but the problem with the Falcons is it hasn't been their offense that's been the trouble. It's been their defense just can't stop anybody. So I think, you know, Matt Ryan and that offense has actually been pretty good. It's just been underrated because the defense has been so bad. So, but I think overall that's a really good point. I think it makes number two receivers that much more important. Every team is going to have two receivers, I think, going forward.
Absolutely. And when you look at fantasy value, I look forward to hearing your thoughts with Danny Hyphens on a Dantasy Fantasy Podcast, which is available on theringer.com and your podcatchers. And check out Danny on Twitter at Danny B. Kelly. Always a pleasure, Danny. We look forward to chatting with you again next week, because I'm sure we'll have other interesting trends developing in the NFL, like it always happens.
Definitely. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Danny. You got it. That is Danny Kelly. Always great insight into what's happening around the National Football League. And there was a lot to kind of get to from yesterday's action as well. I mean, the Minnesota Vikings, now 4-2. Kirk Cousins, you want to talk about a guy who looked like a turkey early in the season and is redeeming himself quite a bit? It is Kirk Cousins. And that offense all of a sudden looks a lot better. Adam Thielen was getting involved. Stephon Diggs went off. The Minnesota Vikings, overall, it is starting to come together a little bit for them. 4-2 on the season. Will it continue? But keep an eye on those Vikings.
I mean, the Vikings were always a good team heading into the year. Kirk Cousins just needs to hit the baseline. And yesterday, he more than hits the baseline. But when he doesn't, that's when those serious concerns come out, is because we know at best he's just a top 15 quarterback. Like, maybe just at the very end of that, like just the average quarterback. But when he hits the baseline and you're putting him in positions to succeed, you've got him in play action, like, you can get actually good value of having Kirk Cousins as your starting QB. Now that finally the passing game is starting to come alive, yeah, the Vikings look a lot stronger. And I think Adam Thielen was right 2 weeks ago when he was kind of not complaining, but just venting his frustration, saying, like, look, you can't just have Dalvin Cook run for 140 yards every game. Like, that's not going to work. You've got two excellent receivers here, and you've got tight ends that can catch the ball as well. You got to get more involved. You can't be afraid to put trust in your receivers. And Seems like that message was really well received by Kirk Cousins. It could have gone the other way. If he had an ego, he could have been like, bro, like I'm the QB.
But that's not how it works. But that's not how it works because it's the offensive coordinator who runs the playbook for them too, right? And that, yes, Kirk Cousins took some criticism, but that was also more of a shot at Stefanski than anything. It's we gotta expand the playbook a little bit because the reason for that too is Mike Zimmer wanted them to run the ball a lot more. So I get it became Thielen versus Kirk Cousins, but more than anything, Vic, I'd say that was a message towards the coaching staff.
Yeah, it's kind of the way I took it. You know, obviously Cousins has to perform,
yeah,
but it's kind of the way I took it as well, that you've invested all this money into your receiving core, Kyle Rudolph.
You're paying your quarterback this much money, let him throw the ball.
If you just look at the way the cap structure is for the Vikings, like all the money is going to passing the ball. Dalvin Cook's on a rookie deal. Their offensive line, they've invested some draft picks too, so they're not paying them a lot yet. And you're doing everything to not feature all the things you're paying for. So I think that was a big shot at Zimmer and Stefanski as much as it was at Kirk Cousins, who wasn't performing, but... Mm-hmm. It was more about game plan and philosophy than it was just Cousins.
You think Stephon Diggs wants to get traded now? Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I was saying, like, he was getting open.
Yeah.
These opportunities were going to start coming. And they finally have a massive day.
Well, to your point about the double coverage on number one receivers, Stephon Diggs has a big night, and Adam Thielen has a quiet one. You know, like,
well, he still got a touchdown, no?
That's, yeah. Well, yeah, he had a touchdown, but, like, in terms of his overall impact, like, 6 catches for 57 yards, not exactly the trademark Adam Thielen type of game. But all I'm saying is that there is something going on where the number one receivers, and you can argue which one's the number one guy in Minnesota, but when one is clamped down on, the other needs to thrive and have an opportunity to, you know, kind of have that boom weekend. That's what we saw out of Stephon Diggs here.
Oh, we'll talk more NFL a bit later in the show. We'll get to the biggest turkey in the NFL early in the season. We've been talking about the positives of Thanksgiving when we're doing something on the negative side of Thanksgiving, the biggest turkey so far in the NFL, and we'll do NFL power rankings. But before we get to that, we will give you the latest on the Vancouver Canucks. A bit of a shakeup in goal. What does that mean for Thatcher Demko? We will discuss right here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Study the playbook. Satyar Shah and John Jang on Sportsnet 650.
On the left boards for Pedersen in the corner, banks it behind the goal. It rolls off the dasher to JT Miller. Right corner now back to the line. Tandem with a shot. Tipped by Pedersen. Rebound. Pedersen scores. Brock Besser with his first of the year. 5:01 into the first. The Canucks take a 1-0 lead.
And the pregame show, we were talking about Brock Besser yet to score. Well, there it is. The puck gets dumped in. Carter Hart lets it go around. Brock Besser actually ends up getting it. And he puts it around behind the net. And Miller, he gets on Provorov in the far corner and picks it up. And it just gets thrown on net. Pedersen tips it. And Brock Besser on the doorstep for the rebound. The Canucks are up 1-0.
Another first in the books. Brock Besser getting his first goal of the season in game number 4. Now up to 3 points in 4 games. Canucks are hosting the Detroit Red Wings tomorrow night before heading on the road. Canucks played 4 games in 2 weeks. They will play 4 games in 6 days starting tomorrow night at home. So the schedule gets a lot more difficult, and it's not the ideal time to be losing your starting goalie, which is what has happened. The Vancouver Canucks announced today that Zane McIntyre has been recalled from Utica and that Jacob Markstrom is away from the team to attend a personal family matter, and the hope is Jacob will rejoin the Canucks on the road, but it may not happen until the weekend when they have back-to-back games against the Devils and Rangers. So you could see Thatcher Demko get back-to-back starts, Detroit tomorrow, then maybe even Thursday against the Blues.
And maybe even Saturday against the Devils, right?
Depending on when Markstrom rejoins the team.
Yeah, so not great for Jacob Markstrom. Again, we wish him all the very best. We're not going to speculate as to what the detail is there, but it doesn't seem to be, and I know some people were curious, it doesn't seem to be injury-related. I don't think the Canucks would disguise any sort of injury with this personal leave of absence. So again, wishing him and his family all the very best here. But for Thatcher Demko, this is really, It's a great opportunity to get back in the crease, to work off the rust, and again, show with confidence that you can be a capable goaltender. And I don't want to like just use the term backup, but of course that's what he is. But even so, don't be a backup that comes in and all of a sudden the team has to play differently in front of you because they just don't know if you're going to be the same type of guy. You want to show your teammates that anytime you're called into action, you can just go out and play your game. I'm going to give you the same quality of goaltending that Jacob's been giving you. The only thing with Demko, we haven't seen him a lot over the past 2 years, mostly because of injury, but he's been working with Ian Clark a lot, right? And in the same way that we see the evolution of Jacob Markstrom under Ian Clark, you know, what's the evolution of Thatcher Demko going to be like under this guy?
We're
going to
find out very soon, and the Canucks will need both goalies if they are going to be a playoff team. And right now, because Jacob Markstrom is away, whether he's ready for it or not, Thatcher Demko will be relied upon for a couple of games at the very least. There is NHL action ongoing right now, so let's take a look at the NHL scoreboard at the moment. Bick, what is happening around the NHL right now?
Right now, Bruins and Ducks. Pasternak put the Bruins up 1-0 on a power play goal. Panthers and Devils tied at 1 thanks to Huberdeau and Hall, and the Blues leading the Islanders. Tarasenko. It's like all the star players are scoring today. Pasternak, Hall, Huberdeau.
Matt Barzal just left the game there for the Islanders. Mm-hmm. Looks a little tough there for the New York Islanders.
Stars Sabres drops at noon. So if you're preparing food all day and you want something on in the background, hockey is aplenty.
And the most exciting match, scoreless between the Senators and the Wild.
I thought you were going to say the Avalanche Capitals yet to come.
Yes, that would be a fun night.
Although I should say, like, the Oilers Blackhawks later today.
I was going to say, we're going to take a look at the Pacific Division for a second and just the Western Conference because there is some news on one team that is hoping to get back into the postseason, losing a key defenseman. We'll talk about that in a second. But yes, in Canada today, it is Thanksgiving Monday. In the U.S., it is both Columbus Day and U.S. Indigenous Peoples Day. Mm-hmm. So that is why in the States, they also have early holiday hockey being played right now.
It's a great time of year. It's a great time of year here, guys. You get to sit back, and you know what? Maybe you're still in pajamas. I respect that. I respect that.
Are you a pajamas guy?
Oh, well, for like sweatpants, right? Yeah.
But pajamas and sweatpants are different. Like,
yeah.
Pajamas are PJs.
I don't really have PJs anymore. I used to when I was young, of course.
Like monogram pajamas?
I don't know what that is.
Like pajamas where you're like your name is on it?
Nah, I never had one of those. But
yeah, I can't wait to get money to have monogram pajamas.
I got to Google that.
Yeah. I have plaid pajamas.
I do have pajamas for every day of the week.
You do?
Wow.
I'm a big flex on pajamas.
This
guy.
Man sleeps.
Ooh, I like it. I like it.
Yeah, I do.
This man sleeps.
You guys are well aware of my nap schedule. Shoot.
Yeah, you probably have longer naps than you sleep at night.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Depending on.
It'd be a lot closer than people realize.
Yeah. I know.
I know.
You've woken up for like
work.
five-hour naps in the afternoon.
Yeah. I do some of my best work at like 2 a.m.
Have you guys ever heard of the Ubermensch sleeping schedule?
Is that like where you sleep 20 minutes every 3 hours?
That's it. And apparently it's supposed to bring out the peak level of efficiency.
I don't trust that at all.
Yeah, I don't trust that.
Yeah,
either.
It sounds super dangerous. But it's a thing. Yeah. I just wanted to bring that up. Yeah.
Well, because usually at like 2 a.m., everything's quiet. There's no like city noise.
It's like late night or early morning. I find sometimes I'll wake up at 4 a.m. and I just can't get back to sleep.
Yeah.
And I just sit and I'm like, wow, I'm being super productive. I get a lot of work done.
Mm. Do some of my best research at that hour.
So. Yeah, late night, early morning. I find in the afternoons, it's distracting. There's too
much
going on.
Plus, sometimes I'll just wake up out of a deep slumber and be like, what are Tyler Myers' zone starts? I got to look this up. And before you know it, you're down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. I know. It's like having those nightmares. But did I have the shooting percentage differential correct? Wait, I got to go check this out. Duncan chimes into our Subway text line. Usually monogram PJs are made out of silk.
Oh.
Totally.
Bick is fancy.
Well, he said he wants monogram.
Yeah.
He doesn't have them.
Okay, fair enough.
He wants
them. We all got ambitions.
One day.
That's fair.
One day.
That's when I'll know I made it, when I have monogram PJ money.
That's got BN right on the pocket there.
Which Canuck would be the one who has monogrammed PJ?
Louis Erickson.
don't even try
to convince me otherwise.
The Emperor probably has no claws.
Probably.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know. So,
you know who?
I kind of want to say Jacob Markstrom, but I'm not sure.
Jacob Markstrom. I could see.
That's a lot of silk.
Antoine Roussel, for sure.
Oh, yeah, baby.
And he's got a matching one for his cat.
That's what I'm saying.
But, yeah.
But he's kind of that, like, blue-collar guy, too.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Which is,
hey, blue-collar guys
he's also French.
Themselves.
Don't forget, he's French.
I know, but I feel like you're saying it because he's French.
No, I'm saying
and
I'm giving him
his personality.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, who else would it be? I mean, Petey has some style. Would we just surprise you if Elias Pettersson?
Oh yeah,
has
that'd
like
be
monogram
the finest
silk
Italian.
I mean, he's still on his rookie deal though. Maybe after he signs his,
maybe he's got an endorsement.
I don't know any PJ endorsement brand.
PDPJs.
Well,
coming
about,
soon to a
how about Huggy Bear? I mean, I'm sure Huggy Bear has them.
I mean, he's already getting called Huggy Bear. I don't know if he can have silk.
Yeah,
pajamas.
I don't know.
And by the way, Huggy Bear is not a nickname that I'm giving Quinn Hughes, but Canucks players are calling him Huggy Bear. And apparently the veterans are making a big push to make it stick.
Secret Weapon Q. Sounds so much better than
that's
Huggy Bear.
That's too much of a mouthful. Secret Weapon Q?
Or just Q.
Yeah, Q.
Q ball.
Q what?
Q ball.
Q ball? No.
Yeah.
No. Just Q. Q is fine.
Okay.
You can't have like a 3-word nickname.
Q balls. Know? Oh, but like, yeah, Secret Weapon King?
Yeah, it should just be one.
Fair enough.
Hey, what about Oscar Fantenberg? I think that's my answer.
Oscar Fantenberg?
Hot dog.
I mean, we don't talk about him enough, so he can be the one with monogram PJs. Yeah.
Mm. Why not? It is. That's pretty, imagine Travis Green and monogram PJs.
I can see that.
Coaching.
Yeah. Well, because in soccer, like a lot of managers will wear the tracksuit on the sidelines, and it has like the name on it, right? Mm-hmm. How come that's not a hockey thing? Travis wearing the suit with like.
Remember when John Tortorella last year, when he was sick, had a hoodie on and he got ripped for it. It's like, why are you wearing a hoodie behind the bench?
Wasn't it
like,
Murph who
sick. And he wore a hoodie himself. Yeah. He's like, I've been hanging out too much with the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah,
Torts might be the only coach that could pull off a look like that.
I mean, AV could pull that off.
AV's got some style.
You think?
He was styling last on Saturday.
Well, I mean,
saw him walking the halls in his
it's
vest.
One thing to, yeah,
like,
it's one thing
right,
to style.
I gotta start wearing vests with no jacket more often.
But pull off the sweater behind the bench?
Oh, yeah, totally.
I don't know.
Totally could do it.
You know who could? Probably Ralph Krueger.
Sure.
He's got that, like, James Bond villain look, which just only really, the only thing I mean to say by that, he's just sophisticated and intelligent, but dangerous.
You sophisticated
and ultimately the plan fails.
Yeah.
Just like every Bond.
There you go. Buffalo Sabres.
Oh, poor Buffalo Sabres. Now, as far as the Pacific Division is concerned, there was some injury news for a team trying to get back into the postseason, the Arizona Coyotes. And they're a team that also needs some health on the back end. But now Nicklas Hjalmarsson is out for at least 3 months with a broken bone. So that is a big loss for them. And they haven't gotten off to the start they wanted so far. And it's only a handful of games in. And you can't overrate or overreact to injuries or what's happening early on. But there are some interesting trends already in the Pacific Division, John.
Well, I mean, look no further than the team that continues to be undefeated in this division and one of the top teams in the league, the Edmonton Oilers. I mean, 5-0 to start the year. Okay, I'm a little flabbergasted, as you can tell. But I think what we're seeing, Sat, is the point that you've made time and time again, is that when you have a new coach, there usually is a buy-in through the first couple of months of the season. Where
if
they,
a coach is capable.
Right.
And Dave Tippett is capable.
Exactly. Dave Tippett there in Edmonton. And I think a lot of people look at Anaheim and people were wondering, like, what is Dallas Eakins really going to do here? Because his first stint in Edmonton, really, you couldn't put the blame on Dallas Eakins because that team was, you know, inherently flawed. We know that much. And yet here he is with the Anaheim Ducks, a team that most of us had not being one of the playoff-bound teams, but certainly a team that is capable of doing some damage if they pull together consistency, if they can stay healthy, if John Gibson continues to play at his level. And we're seeing that. Like, the new coaches are the two teams that are leading the Pacific Division. It's only 5 games each. But the Edmonton Oilers being, you know, perfect right now, I think, is impressive. But I think you have to really give a lot of credit to what Dallas Eakins has been doing there in Anaheim. They're a team that obviously is old up front. They still have Getzlaff. Kessler's not playing. They got rid of Corey Perry. They're trying their best to shed all the salary and all these old players. But where it matters, they're getting the buy-in from the players. And John Gibson, as you mentioned last week, one of the best goaltenders in the league, but maybe one of the most underrated guys because he plays largely in a subpar Anaheim team.
They have some talented defensemen in Anaheim, and their process has been a lot better. I know Bick also mentioned Anaheim as one of those teams before the season. He's like, keep an eye on them. I could see them being a lot better than people think they are because the main issues they seem to have were systemic under the last head coach, Randy Carlisle, who, let's just say, was not implementing a modern system to have success.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing that change to some degree, and they are having early season success. So there are some positive trends for Anaheim. But overall, they're still getting outchanced. So I'll see kind of where they're at a bit later in the season, but encouraging start for Anaheim. On Edmonton, this is exactly how Edmonton should be playing. You don't have the horses. This is like the 2019 version of how the Minnesota Wild used to play. Mm. Not quite as defensively minded, because the game has changed a lot. You don't have teams sitting in the neutral zone and clogging it up as much as those Wilds team and those trap teams used to in the past. But in a more modern version, that's what the Oilers are doing. Hanging back in the neutral zone, trying to force turnovers, and essentially play the crap out of your top guys.
Yeah.
They're playing Draisaitl and McDavid a lot, and they are tearing the league apart. And when you are playing a lot better defensively, you give up shots on the outside, you protect your net, and you rely on your skill players just... Like, you know what it's like? It's like the Seahawks, almost, where we kind of say they're just kind of trucking along and then allowing Russell Wilson to win on third down.
Sure.
That's kind of the way the Edmonton Oilers have been approaching this season.
Just stay in it and give your best player the chance to win the
and
game.
And if you play well enough defensively and limit chances of gains, you rely on your goalies and your defense take away the high danger scoring chances, and then just allow your top guys to take the puck whenever they can.
Yeah.
Can you win 3-2 games? Can you win 2-1 hockey games? Can you win one goal games because your best players just find a way to get come through at the very end? And it shows how much different a team can look with the best player on the planet as long as you put him in a position to have success.
It's kind of reminded you of Calgary that year when they beat the Canucks in the playoffs.
Yeah, kind of like, you know what, that's a good way of looking at it.
And Colorado, where they invited pressure, and then hopefully because of it, you open up seams that when you make a mistake, now you can go to get after them, create odd man rushes, and just kind of with your very limited skill advantage in Connor McDavid, you know, hope McDavid's on the ice for those turnovers.
Exactly. And that's, you're right about Calgary. That's how they played. And it was all about the stretch pass. Mm-hmm. I think they had the highest number of odd man chances and breakaways in the league that year, because they sat back and then just tried to hit their guys with stretch passes as soon as a turnover was happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to some degree the way Edmonton is playing as well. And as long as they buy into the system and they play well defensively as a team, you have the two best players on, like Duncan mentions to our Subway text line, McDavid and Draisaitl. Are they the new Crosby and Malkin? You know, we'll see if they get to that level, but you see the level they can get to when they're at their best. And when you have two of the best players, arguably the two best players to start the season in the league right now, then you are going to have success.
Well, Draisaitl did have 50 goals and 100-plus points last season, and he's just only building on that. I think one thing for the Edmonton Oilers is that so far it's working, but you still need what you probably don't have, which is depth scoring. So almost all of the goals have come exclusively from that top line or the second line. Apart from that, like, Draisaitl has goals, McDavid, James Neal. After that, in terms of just forwards, Zach Kassian and Thomas Yurko. That's it. Nugent Hopkins doesn't have a goal, right?
But you know Nugent Hopkins' offense will come. Like, he's not a guy that's going to, you know, not score all season.
I know,
like, he's
going
to start scoring.
But that it was kind of the Achilles heel for the Edmonton Oilers last year. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have enough goal scorers. We know the comments that were made about Toby Reeder, you know, like, he's got to score goals for us in order to win games. Like, a little overstated, because Toby Reeder is a role player at best, but I see what Edmonton was trying to talk about. They need more depth scoring. Right now, they're doing well because it's five games in and it's working. It's a formula that obviously is paying off in the early.
Yeah, James Neal has seven goals.
Yeah, and he's part of that top line, though.
But I'm just saying that you're getting a lot of production from that top line. You're right. Yeah. You will need. I mean, Zach Kassian has 5 points and 3 goals.
Kassian's been actually quite.
So they are getting some scoring from the rest of their team, but they're not going to be a team that's going to score a lot. Top to bottom. They're not going to be a team that's going to go out there and play high-flying hockey. Their key to success all year will be to buy in defensively to what Dave Tippett's trying to do, and them having just enough scoring to win close games.
Mm.
And so far, early in the season, that success is happening. So can it continue all year? We've seen teams like this, like Bick mentioned. We saw the Calgary Flames do this some years back with Bob Hartley. We saw the Colorado Avalanche as well. Overall, it does need some luck, and you need some good goaltending, but you can catch that for a season and put yourself in a position to be a playoff team. And ultimately, right now, you can't ask for a better start from the Edmonton Oilers.
They have been certainly impressive, and I think you got to give them credit, because at least they're finding the right coach and the right system to get the most out of their players in what we know is a kind of limited roster, very top heavy. On the other side of things, if we're talking about trends in the Pacific Division, what about the Sharks and the fact that, yes, back-to-back wins now, but
Well, looking
there's
a lot,
a lot of red flags still on that team.
No, for sure. But if we're, you know, if we're looking at some of the positives, Patrick Marleau came back last night and he played at home, and we got a great ovation. It was nice to see. Like he got all teary, and you know he had obviously left that organization to sign with the Maple Leafs. So he got traded, and then he wanted to sign back. They didn't want him initially, and then because of injuries and a bad start, they doubled back and said, "Hey, you want to come back?" And so it's a nice story with Patrick Marleau as well. But they are still very deadly once they get into the offensive zone. And as much as I have my concerns about the San Jose Sharks, and yes, they are flawed, and they are one injury to Brian Burns or Erik Karlsson from being in a lot of trouble on that back end. Marty Jones has to be a lot better in goal. But once they get set up in the offensive zone, they are a load to handle. On the power play, they are incredibly dynamic. So I would caution us predicting the demise of the San Jose Sharks too soon. A lot of concerns, and ultimately they're a team I think is going to be fighting for a playoff spot, not entrenching itself in a playoff spot. But the last couple of games, if anything, has made me look at the Sharks and say, okay, there is a way here for them to still be a dangerous team.
For me, it just comes down to the goaltending, because you're right. When healthy, that defense is still going to be effective. They're going to have plenty of opportunities to score points and put it up. But do you have the trust in Martin Jones to be the guy that'll take you to the glory land? And that's the ultimate question with San Jose. And I'm not sure that I do. And I'm not sure that I'm going to get to a point this season where I feel like Martin Jones has exercised those demons and is ready to, even for himself mentally.
He was really good last night, though. Last night, he was really good.
You're right.
He played really solidly for him. But you're right. I mean, goaltending will be a big question mark for San Jose. But it's not like I'm looking at San Jose as being a Stanley Cup contender. The question is, how much ahead of the Canucks could they be?
Mm-hmm.
That's really the conversation. And I still look at them as being a team that's going to be fighting tooth and nail with the Canucks for that playoff spot, whether it's a wild card spot, whether it's a third spot in the division.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't see San Jose being that far behind in the rear view. So, yes, we're not having a conversation about San Jose as a cup contender, but do we dismiss them as a playoff contender?
It's early.
You really want to, don't you?
I
tell you really want to. You want to dismiss the San Jose Sharks.
Well, because for me, I would love a little bit of chaos. Like, they ink Erik Karlsson to that huge contract. They've got Brent Burns on the books for 6 more years at $8 million. Vlasic, by the way, just started his extension, 7 more years. Like, there's a lot of internal struggle where I'm like, yeah, the Sharks team is good, and it's so automatic that you're going to see in the playoffs. But what if they're not there? What if they miss the playoffs? What if the window is closed? And what if, all of a sudden, the San Jose Sharks are in a sudden state where identity crisis happens, and they have to start thinking about, geez, we're going to have to start selling these guys because we don't have the prospects necessary to start retooling like the Pittsburgh Penguins might want to try.
Their thing is they have a couple of prospects, but they're a couple of years away.
Yep.
So it's that gap of how long do you have to wait for some of those guys to come through?
Because I was thinking, like, you know, when Elliot and Jeff Merrick were on the 31 Thoughts, sort of detailing last week the Pittsburgh Penguins, pardon me, and how there's an internal conversation there about, do we need to do the Chicago thing where, you know, we suck for a couple of years, but we arm ourselves with good young talent?
Well, no. To be accurate about exactly what they said was, it was like, when do you get to that position where you're forced, you know, and as long as you have Malkin and you have Crosby, you're going for it. But that Chicago fall off will come at some point, because there will be a point in time where you have these guys signed to long-term deals and they're just not going to be able to live up to that contract. When do you get to that point?
It's an admirable philosophy to want to go in every year while you've got Malkin and
Crosby. And they should.
But you're right.
But they should.
But we're seeing that there is, like, the economics of the NHL is that can only carry you for so long before you start to see you don't have enough of the young talent coming through.
At some point, it's the young talent, but it's also those players. When those players don't live up to those contracts, that's when you're screwed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the day Malkin and Crosby don't live up to their contracts is the day that you're going to see that, you know, Chicago Blackhawks, Brent Seabrook type contracts that really drag you down.
Right.
And you're not going to be able to overcome those. You get to that at some point. With San Jose, are they there at that point yet? That remains to be seen. But we'll talk a lot more about the Vancouver Canucks and the Pacific Division. A lot of great submissions to our Subway text line. We'll get to you. And we're going to talk about the Detroit Red Wings, who are here in Vancouver tomorrow night. What do you expect from the Wings? We'll get a closer look from the city of Detroit right here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
It's The Playbook with Satyar Shah and John Jang on Sportsnet 650.
You talk about that a lot as a coach in the NHL, and this game was one of those ones. We talked about it. It was like a grinding chess match where every move, every inch mattered, and it seems like, you know, when you look at analytical stuff where the puck, where the game's played, it's on the walls a lot. and try to get it inside. But if you're not on the walls, if you're not good on the walls, it can be a long night for you.
Canucks head coach Travis Green talking about the additions to this Canucks squad. Guys like JT Miller winning board battles, Michael Ferland being added for some more toughness, although he has kind of struggled to start his Canucks career through four games. Haven't seen the best version of Michael Ferland yet. We are seeing the best of JT Miller, and boy, does it look pretty, pretty impressive. And one of the things this Canucks team is going to have to do if they are going to have that success, you have to be able to win games differently. Yes, you need to be able to win those high-flying games where you have to outscore the opposition in a shootout-type performance. You also need to win close-checking games. And you also need to win games where you're facing a bigger, more physical team that lives down low, like the Flyers did. And that was one of the more encouraging things we saw on Saturday. The Canucks were able to play a different style of game and have success.
It was also a game where your bottom six actually had a really good performance in terms of bringing that physicality a little bit, winning those battles along the boards. I think anytime you're mentioning that over the past five games or four games for Vancouver, the guy that comes right at the top of the list is Jake Virtanen. And I think Jake has done really well for himself over the start of the season is because he's finally seemingly buying into the notion that, like, hey, I don't need to be a scoring contributor. What I can do is be noticeable in terms of my presence on the ice. And even when he's standing still and it's the Flyers that are trying to skate into him, they just bounce off the guy because he's strong, he's he's thick, he's Jake Virtanen. And he's finally, in my estimation, maybe...
He's strong, he's thick, he's Jake Virtanen.
Yeah, so like, I don't know, there's really no other way to put it because, you know, like...
He's strong, he's thick,
he's Jake Virtanen.
He is Jake Virtanen. Well, like... It doesn't even rhyme.
It doesn't need to. Like, it just, it works. And that's kind of what Jake Virtanen is right now this season, four games in. It doesn't rhyme. It doesn't have to be pretty, but it works because he's cluing in. If you don't have to be coming into the year with this expectation that, hey, I got to be a total goal scorer, 40-point guy, and instead I still can be a key part of this team by being me, by being the best version of me in a third-line, fourth-line role, there's still a very, very good place for Jake Virtanen to be a part of this team moving forward for the next like half a decade. If he can live to that role. In years past, he would disappear. And it wouldn't have surprised me that, you know, after a strong showing against LA, that he would disappear for this game over the weekend against Philadelphia. But instead, he is there. And you still notice him bringing those small little details, hitting, getting involved, using his speed the right way. Those are all the best qualities of Jake Virtanen, and he's stringing along consistency, which is the biggest thing that's eluded him. I'm very encouraged by his performance, and I also got to give love, like you mentioned earlier, to that fourth line. Tim Schaller had himself a pretty fine performance. Jay Beagle finally had a good performance. That unit as a whole, I think, really, maybe it's just the kind of game that they thrive in, because they struggled against the quicker Calgary Flames. They struggled against the Edmonton Oilers when, of course, they didn't have a chance to have the last switch, so at times they were kind of hemmed in. But against against a team that is bringing physicality, like the Philadelphia Flyers, and maybe a slower pace, that fourth line is able to do some good things.
Flyers are fast. They're a fast hockey
Their transition
team.
Game is pretty
good. Yeah, I mean, they move the puck really quickly. They have a very mobile defense, and in that third period, when the Flyers were pressing, they really put the boots to the Canucks, and the Canucks kind of got lucky towards the end to get that extra point and bring it to overtime and winning in the shootout ultimately. But overall, the four games, you had the game in Edmonton where the Canucks deserved a better fate, didn't get a point. So it evens out, and over four games, there's been much more good than bad. But to your point about which players who had success against the Flyers and which players can have success against faster, speedier teams. When you have more balance as far as types of players in your roster, you can win other games. But it's interesting to listen to Travis Green and philosophically how important he believes it is to have players that win those board battles because of how tight checking it gets in games against the Flyers, also in the postseason. But you have to win those battles to create a better transition game as well. It goes hand in hand. You want better analytics? Yes. You want players that drive play, that are able to bring the puck into the offensive zone, create more chances and shots for it than against.
Yeah.
But sometimes to get the puck, you need guys that win those battles as well. How good are you along the boards? How good are you down low? And you're seeing that change quite a bit for the Canucks. Look at Tanner Pearson, how well he's been playing down
low. He's
been
really good.
Look at JT Miller, for instance. Those two players have made a big difference. And when Michael Ferland's game does come along, and I still believe it's only a matter of time before Michael Ferland makes more of an impact, but then you're going to have that type of balance as far as stylistically throughout your roster. And which players can have success, we're going to see a different team against the Detroit Red Wings as well on Tuesday. And they're a team that has gotten off to a pretty good start so far.
Yeah, look, the Red Wings, now that they're being headed by Steve Yzerman, I'm not going to put anything past them because we know the magic of Steve Yzerman. But now they're a team that is being led by exciting, dynamic young talent. We're seeing Anthony Mantha break through. We've seen Dylan Larkin for years. Now he's finally getting help. And on that defense, a bit of a unknown guy, but a guy that you should be keeping an eye on, Philip Ronick. Like, that's a pretty exciting Red Wings team.
They got a couple of talented, and Dennis Chwalski as well. Let's bring in Max Baltman into the conversation, covering the Detroit Red Wings for The Athletic Detroit. Follow him on Twitter, M_Baltman. Max, thanks for joining us on Sportsnet 650. How are you enjoying Vancouver?
Hey, guys, it's great. I went and had some really good soup dumplings last night. They don't make them like that in Detroit, I'll tell you that.
Well, that's nice. See, there's always something different in each city you visit, and we're glad you enjoy the dumplings here in Vancouver. And you know what? I got to say, this Detroit Red Wings team, we talked about them before the season, a team with a lot of young talent. We have a few veterans as well, and with Steve Yzerman as the new general manager of the team, a lot of positives to look forward to in the future, but as far as the immediate is concerned, Red Wings have looked pretty good, and we look at that young talent, and I'm not saying they're going to be a playoff team this year, but are they a team that can hold its own on most nights?
Well, that's certainly what they've done so far. I think, you know, coming into the year, they're definitely a team that most people are picking, myself included, in the bottom five or so of the league, and what they've shown through these first five games is that their top line is going to do everything in their power to prevent them from being there, right? I mean, that line with Larkin, Mantha, and Bertuzzi has gone toe-to-toe with the best lines they've faced night in, night out, and really held their own. Mantha's among the league's scoring leaders, obviously. But Larkin in there is kind of the guy who drives that line with his energy level. Bertuzzi can win puck battles. That line is going to give them a chance on any given night. And then it's really about how much depth scoring can they get, how much contribution from the back end can they get. So it is a little bit more excitement than I think a lot of people were expecting early in the season from them. And for a fan base in Detroit that's been going through the rebuild, I mean, that's been a welcome surprise.
Well, and I know the rebuild was much maligned, but they've made a lot of moves the past few years, adding a lot of young talent to the team. They have a lot more draft picks coming up. And then you start looking at that defense, right? And you mentioned, you know, John mentioned Philip Hronek, who's been playing a lot, Dennis Chwalski as well. Overall, is that the one area the team might be looking to make more improvements on?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that's the area of the farm system that there's maybe the most kind of on the cusp talent, right? Like Chwalski is a guy who made the team out of camp, and he's been exciting so far. They got Moritz Seider, who they took sixth overall in the last draft in Grand Rapids. He came into the preseason and camp and looked pretty good. So it certainly is an area they can look to add, but I think it's also the area where their talent might be the closest to being ready. When you look up front, really what I think they probably could use is another center in that top six, you know, in the mold of a Dylan Larkin, who can play two ways, who can go toe-to-toe with other teams' top lines, but also score. So it's not a team that's one piece away by any means, but I think you're starting to see the progress, certainly, as that rebuild progresses.
Well, how excited then are you to maybe see Joseph Foligno over the next couple of years? He's already signed to his ELC, similarly with Philip Zadina from that same draft class. And that, we're talking about the future of the Red Wings, which I hope to see sooner rather than later, because it's always nice to see the Red Wings thrive. And how stereotypical would it be that the Red Wings start doing well because of the success of their development and their young players?
Right. And Valeno's a guy who certainly you can point to with that. They took him, you know, he went later than he was expected to in the draft at 30th overall. But then last year he went up and absolutely lit up the queue. Now, he was an exceptional status player, so I think that was his fourth season in Quebec. And now it'll be a new transition, new challenge for him in Grand Rapids. But he's definitely a guy you could point to and say he's someone who could fill that role in a top of the line and a center role. I don't know if he's necessarily that one center, but certainly if you're just looking for a guy who can generate offense, play both sides of the puck two ways, that's what they want Joe Foligno to be, and he's certainly got the talent to do it.
Before Steve Yzerman came and became the new general manager of the Red Wings, I mean, the organization already had Ken Holland, so two guys with very great long resumes and sparkly ones at that. But when Steve Yzerman came in to start becoming the new direction and the new leader of this organization, did it instill like a new air of confidence to this team, even going down to the players, because of the fact that Steve Yzerman did some very, very good things for the team over there in Tampa?
Well, I think more than that, what it might be is just anytime you change something, it kind of re-shakes things up for the players, right? I mean, Steve Yzerman's not the guy who drafted or traded for or signed almost any of these guys. So it does maybe put a little bit of a jolt, I think, in from that sense. But as long as Yzerman's not lacing them up, I don't know how much he can really do to help the guys on the ice. And I think to some degree, what you're seeing is the result of a lot of progress that, some of these players like Anthony Mantha have logged over 4 or 5 years, and they're now seeing the dividends of it, work that they've put in over the summers and pushing through some adversity. And I think when you Mantha being the perfect example of sometimes it just takes guys 3-4 years for it to really click. And so I think more than anything, probably that.
Well, and as far as one of the young players they have that maybe doesn't get as much run around the league is Dylan Larkin. I mean, you get to watch him on a nightly basis. And because the Wings haven't been all that good as a team the past couple of years, he gets some love. But do people truly, do you think, outside of Detroit understand or know how good of a two-way player he is already?
I don't think so, no. And I think I watch him, like you said, every game. He's outstanding. He goes toe-to-toe with other teams' best players just about every night. And more often than not, the Red Wings, despite generally being overmatched on a talent basis with most teams they face, his line manages to tilt the ice more often than not. And I think that's hugely valuable when you look at how he is as a skater, how he is as an aggressive forechecker, as an aggressive backchecker. He'll mix it up a little bit, and he, you know, he's came close to a point per game last year. So he's definitely a guy who, the more you watch him, the more you really appreciate how well-rounded his game is. And if the Red Wings are able to get more of a profile as a team, I would imagine his sort of individual star power picks up a bit as well.
Well, I mean, you look at him, you look at Anthony Mantha, they've been lights out. The one player who had a really good season last year was Andreas Athanasiou, who did score 30 goals. You know, not off to the start he wanted so far. But where do you think his game's at, considering he's been injured as well?
Right, and that's the big question is, you know, he missed the first couple of games, so he's really 3 games in. So, you know, everyone's sitting here looking, it's almost 2 weeks into the season. Well, for him, it's really more of 1 week, and how much can you really read into it? Their line certainly hasn't been as productive as you would want from a guy with a 30-goal scorer on it, but I think that's where the Red Wings are at right now, is trying to figure out, how do you get him going? Are there any changes you have to make, or is it just a wait and see and wait until that line starts to click? You know, certainly timing is a big thing early in the season too, especially for a guy who wasn't always practicing toward the end of the preseason and toward the end of training camp, because he just kind of had a nagging tweak. So he's sort of the next piece of the puzzle that the Red Wings need to click here if they're going to keep this up.
How good has Dennis Shalowski been as well? I mean, just the fact that, hey, it's a local kid coming home. We always like to pump up the tires of guys that are from the Lower Mainland. He's from Langley. Now just 21. So, like, we haven't even seen the best version of what this guy could be.
Oh, no, not even close. And I think, you know, Dennis has made huge strides. Every single year, basically, they've wanted him to get better, and he's spent a lot of time, a lot of summers in Detroit working in the gym, working with their player development guys. What they really wanted from him this last summer is to improve his defensive game, improve the urgency, improve his ability to recognize danger and shut down plays. He came into the preseason and he did it. And I don't know if most people expected him on the opening night roster this season, because there was going to be a little bit of a jam. And if he wasn't going to be a no-doubt lineup guy, well, there was a spot in Grand Rapids where he could be. And instead, he came in, did everything they asked him to do, won a job, and I think he's looked really good to start the season.
And now, before we let you go, Max, what happens in this market a lot is a local kid doesn't get drafted or passed by, and we sit here and we do a lot of hand-wringing. And no, and I know Quinn Hughes isn't from Michigan, but he did play for Michigan. How much does he get brought up in conversation from Red Wings fans, considering he was picked one spot after Philip Zadina?
At every opportunity, I'll tell you that. I mean, a lot of people followed Quinn Hughes' career closely at the University of Michigan. He was a superstar there. I think most people thought he was going to be a superstar at the NHL level, and the early returns are yes, he probably will be. So you hear his name a lot in Michigan, and I can't wait to see him play live tonight or tomorrow night, because he's just an electric player, man. He's so fun to watch, and the fans of Vancouver are lucky to have him.
Oh, absolutely. We've had a lot of fun watching Quinn Hughes. And Max, always appreciate you joining us, and I look forward to seeing you at the rink tomorrow night.
All right, sounds good, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. That's Max Baltman. Yeah. Follow him on Twitter at @M_Baltman, courtesy of The Athletic. Detroit does a great job covering the Red Wings. But that Wings team, man, like, it's, we talked about them before the season.
Yeah.
I could see a way that they're not one of the worst teams in the league. They're not a playoff team, right? Like, but can they be like the Canucks were last year? And I mean, be a 500 team pretty much. Like 81, 82 points? Can they be in that conversation? And if they are, that means every night they're not going to be a team you just simply walk over.
Well, that's it. And I think, okay, so the biggest question mark on that roster really is kind of similar to San Jose, but, you know, the poor man's version right now, is simply the goaltending. Do you have trust in Bernier? Do you have trust in Jimmy Howard? And that might be the one thing that just keeps them back from being a really dynamic team with all the speed and firepower they've got on defense, on forward. And don't forget, like Max was kind of talking about, the power of the depth system. And these guys might still be one full year away, but I'm still very high on Philip Zadina. I really love the idea of watching Philip Zadina playing on a line with Mantha and Dylan Larkin one day.
Super talented, and I would love Philip Zadina in his draft year as well. But if you want to talk, be honest, he hasn't quite developed the way they wanted him to so far. They were really hoping that he would take a step last year, and he did okay in Grand Rapids, but he wasn't incredible. Like, he had an okay season. So far this year, he's been okay, and I'm not saying they're concerned about him, but it is telling that a lot of fans are looking at Quinn Hughes saying, maybe that's the guy you should have taken, not Philip Zadina.
Oh, yeah.
Bick?
What, we talked a lot about coming into the season that the Canucks were kind of like an 88-point team in a group of 88-point teams, and the way the points get dispersed, you know, depending on bounces and stuff like that, will dictate if they have 96, 99, 82, whatever it is. But there's another tier below that, obviously, where the same principle applies, that, you know, Detroit's in this group of, like, they're about an 80-point team. But things can go really wrong. They can finish with 74, or things can go really right, and they finish with 76. But they've got the talent on that forward group, at least. Like, Larkin's one of my favorite players to watch.
And he's so – and like Max mentioned, he is for sure – I don't think people truly understand how good of a two-way center he already is.
Totally. And I talked a lot about last year with Tyler Bertuzzi. And he gets the Team Canada invite last year. And it's those type of players that I think are getting unnoticed across the league, or at least, you know, as far as garnering attention. But very strong, smart players that maybe don't have 35-goal ceilings, but certainly can provide 20 goals. And over the course of the season, not like that matters when you have a collection of these guys. And Mantha maybe is taking a step here, which is encouraging to see. I know a lot of people have been hyped on him for so long. The forward depth is what you want to like about this team. But the defense is where I always just go, you know, wince and kind of look at it. It's like, I don't know if this is where someone can build a team off of right now.
And the point Max made, too, is they have a lot of prospects coming up that they feel good about over the next, but they're just not ready there yet. But they feel good about the guys that are on the cusp.
Yeah.
But as far as the style of game you're going to see tomorrow night between the Canucks and Red Wings, a lot different than what we saw from the Philadelphia Flyers. And I know Numbers G12 on Twitter chimed in and says, I'm going to my first game tomorrow night. What do you guys think is going to happen? It's always hard to predict who's going to win. Vancouver should beat Detroit. I still look at Vancouver and say, this is a game they should win. This is a game on home ice. Yeah. You should win. But I am looking forward to seeing it be a pretty fast-paced game. I do think we're going to see a lot more transition back and forth. I don't know if it'll be high scoring. It depends on the goalies, obviously. Detroit will give up chances. Detroit has given up 16 goals so far.
Yeah.
So you know they are going to give up some chances. They also will score some, so it will depend on how Thatcher Demko plays. But I would anticipate you see some pretty fun back-and-forth hockey tomorrow night.
I think it really just comes down to, and I know it's like one of the keys to the game, and it's such a cheesy cliche wave, but it comes down to special teams. And can the Vancouver Canucks make them play, make them pay on the power play? Can your penalty kill still remain a sparkling unit? This Red Wings team is skill based. We know that much. So this is again one of those games where the fourth line might struggle, because the games that they haven't done well in terms of just, you know, holding average, holding steady and not getting your teeth kicked in terms of possession and controlling shot metrics, they have struggled against teams that are quick and have skill and have speed, and that's kind of the Red Wings so far. It's very Steve Yzerman like, and I know like Max makes the point he didn't draft really any of these guys, but the DNA components of the team in Tampa that was all basically skill and speed based. It's kind of the similar system that you're trying to introduce here in Detroit, where it's speed and skill-based, but you've got a couple of guys that can obviously play down low.
They just have a long way to go before they're in the Tampa Bay's conversation.
What, no, you like
about,
on that team.
What you like about Steve Yzerman is he's shown very high degree of competency as a general manager, and the moves that he can make for this team moving forward gives you confidence that they will figure it out. Is he the perfect guy to take them from rebuilding to contending over the next couple of years?
I would say so.
That's kind of where the conversation with him comes in, because, you know, like Max mentioned, him being there doesn't change much as far as day-to-day how they play on the ice. It's the impact he can have with stability and what moves he can make to improve this roster moving forward. And at what point do they turn these assets, the draft picks, the players, the prospects, how do they turn that into players? Do you just wait? Do you make some trades? Now he has a bevy of assets, and what does he do with them? That's going to be one of the biggest questions surrounding the Detroit Red Wings. Bick?
Both teams right now also in like top 10 scoring chances, not high danger, just general scoring chances. Yeah. And that can be a bit of a, you know, flawed metric, but just the idea of what kind of hockey you may see. Again, scoring chances against, they're both teams giving up quite a few. So you would see probably more open play, which is probably good for, you know, the fans who want to see some guys bump some slumps like a Ferland, or, you know, see Brock Besser continuing growing off of last game and keep that run of form going. It's opportunities to kind of stat pad tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because if you look at it, Vancouver has been in the black as far as scoring chances forward than against. They have more scoring chances forward than against. Mm-hmm. Detroit has a lot of scoring chances, but they also given up one of the highest amounts of scoring chances in the league, and it will come down to the goaltending as well. But you're going to see a far different game because the Philadelphia Flyers are one of the teams that has the best scoring chance differentials. They don't give up a lot of scoring chances because of how they play. So you will see a different style of game. And again, for this Canucks team, can you win different games? Can you play the type of game against the Flyers and win, rely on good goaltending and win those battles along the boards and do just enough to win? And can you win the games where it becomes a bit of a shootout?
Yeah.
And to some degree, these are the types of wins you should get against a Detroit Red Wings team, who we just mentioned might be better than expected. And like Tony Roberts says, if all things go right and everything aligns, maybe they sneak into the playoffs if everything aligns for them. But it's also a team that, like Canucks, should be beating on home ice before they head out on the road. And when the Canucks have played 4 games in 2 weeks and now have 4 games in 6 nights coming up, this victory, this game, not must win, not one of the biggest games in the season. But if you start looking at how much harder it gets when you play 3 games and 4 nights on the road, that's a game you probably should be bagging.
If you want to make your life a little easier in 2020 when the calendar flips, and you want to make it a little easier on yourself when it comes to the final stretch of games, you pick up the wins here. You pick up the wins now when you're fully healthy. You're feeling confidence. The last game on a homestand. Like, this is how you help yourself out. And you're right. By really every metric, the Vancouver Canucks should be the favorites heading into this one tomorrow night. And though they did well against the Philly Flyers in a heavy game, in a physical game, a grinding chess game, like Travis Green said, I feel way more confident when they are asked to go and win skill games. And that's because you're putting your Elias Pettersson, Quinn Hughes, Brock Besser, Bo Horvats as the forefronts of your success. And that, to me, is the recipe for this team moving forward.
We're going to get back to some Canucks talk at the other side, some questions and comments we're going to get to, and we will talk NFL. Who's been the biggest turkey in the NFL so far? And also, we'll do some quick power rankings right here on the home of Vancouver Hockey, Sportsnet 650.
It's the Playbook with Satyar Shah and John Jang on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
No, and I know Quinn Hughes isn't from Michigan, but he did play for Michigan. How much does he get brought up in conversation from Red Wings fans, considering he was picked one spot after Philip Zadina?
At every opportunity, I'll tell you that. I mean, a lot of people...
That's Max Baltman, who just joined us, covering the Detroit Red Wings for The Athletic. He's here in Vancouver to cover the Wings playing the Canucks tomorrow night. And yeah, we do this exercise all the time in Vancouver, crying over a player selected directly after a spot the Canucks selected somebody.
Who could have Nathan Smith been?
Well, who could have Olli Juolevi been? That's the one too, right? Like Matthew Tkachuk, that one always happens for recent ones. You know, yeah. Even Jake Virtanen, Nikolaj Ehlers, and Willie Nylander, that conversation always finds a way to come up. And now, at least for the time being, Canucks fans can do that and say, hey, how do you guys feel about Quinn Hughes going one spot after the guy you guys took?
Feels good.
Well, feels Quinn Hughes is
so good.
Well, and the frustrating part for a lot of Wings fans, like Quinn Hughes just kind of fit everything they kind of wanted. A very mobile defenseman. They're a team that looked for players like that. They needed help. Here's a guy who played in your own backyard. American prospect. A lot of markers what Red Wings fans looked at and said he fits them all.
Yep.
Philip Zadina, though, is super talented as well. And he hasn't been developing the way they had hoped ever since being drafted in 2018. But he is, to be fair to them, I mean, the guy was a top three prospect and he was available at number six, and they hopped on it and took him at number six overall. So, you know, it's easy in hindsight to sit here and say, wring their hands about it. But you look at Quinn Hughes and how he's played so far, looks a lot better than the seventh overall pick.
Would it have been akin to say, let's say the Canucks had the sixth pick this year? and Byram and Putkolzin were on the board, and they took Putkolzin still into that.
And then Byram would be the one. That's a good way of putting it. Let's just, because Byram was already gone, but he been available.
Right. In a scenario.
Yeah, where they took Putkolzin, and directly afterwards, he would have been picked.
Someone in your backyard, someone, you know, franchise need.
Definitely.
You're always looking for D-men. It's probably similar for Red Wings fans.
Yeah. Oh, it's, but
the D-men that could have been.
And
the one that got away.
Well, I mean, they made up for it. Biega.
they got the Bulldog. They got the Bulldog. We should have asked him about Alex Biega. We didn't. We missed the opportunity about Bulldog. But I'll say this about Quinn Hughes. And if you haven't had a chance to watch Quinn Hughes live at Rogers Arena, whenever you get a chance to do so, it is an absolute delight to watch that kid play hockey.
Disney on Ice.
Hughes update.
Yes.
Brother Jack playing right now against the Panthers. Somehow missed, like, from 2 feet out, an empty net.
Bust.
It was unbelievable.
Hey, just squeezing the stick a little too hard.
Well, the puck was bouncing, kind of batted it in, but it was way harder to miss than it was to put it in. He's still looking to get off the schneid.
I know. I still have...
Playing on the third line, and Gusev is playing on the fourth line in New Jersey. It's classic hockey guy saying, you got to earn the time.
Earn the time. Play on the fourth line.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see how those Devils fare so far. Jack Hughes still trying to find his way. Quinn Hughes is having a lot of success in his rookie season. He did get a cup of coffee last year, so better prepared and a bit older than brother Jack to have success this season. But Red Wings fans, tomorrow night, get another chance to watch Quinn Hughes.
Just so you can see on what you missed.
Yeah, be careful before we stunt too much. There's always
I don't get a chance to say this.
Doesn't happen very often.
Yeah,
but it happens every once in a while. A few comments we want to get to here before moving on to some football talk. We were talking about which player on the Canucks would actually have
pajamas, and not just pajamas, but what monogram pajamas?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Chris and Van says alien PJs. And
yeah,
Elias Pettersson having aliens on his pajamas monogram.
I could see that.
That could be a lot of fun. Dan and Brentwood chimes in. We were talking about Pacific Division teams and which seems the early trends because the Edmonton Oilers are off to a fast start. Dan and Brentwood says, this is what we thought Hitchcock could do last year. He actually did get it done for a small sample size. Could Tippett finally be the answer? Something tells me this may be an illusion. I do think they're a playoff team, but certainly not a contender yet. I agree, they're not a contender. Will they be a playoff team? We'll see, ultimately, if they can continue this trend. One of the reasons why I'd say there's a better chance of Tippett getting the most out of this team for a longer stretch, I do think Tippett has a better way of relating to players. And yes, Kyle Turris may disagree based on his experience in Phoenix with Dave Tippett and other players as well. But Ken Hitchcock really had a hard time relating to any players. And it became very evident that his old school way of approaching players wasn't going to work in Edmonton. Early it did, and then at some point it all fell apart. I do think Dave Tippett can find a better way to approach these players. But to Dan and Brentwood's point, they're not going to be perfect all season, and everything's been going their way so far. So they're not as good as their record has indicated, but they're also a team that if they play the way they're playing, they will be in every game.
They're at least doing the things necessary for them to win these games.
Yeah.
So they're limiting chances against. They're actually limiting chances for, but that's kind of what you have to do when you don't have a lot of weapons that you can rely on every single night. However, I think it also speaks volumes that Dave Tippett even went to Edmonton in the first place, because don't forget, he was pretty comfortable there in Seattle. And maybe, you know, he missed being behind the bench so much that he just jumped at the first opportunity. But I don't really think that's the case, because by all means, I think most of us would have seen there being the path road for him just staying with Seattle for a couple more years and then eventually becoming their first ever head coach in the NHL. And obviously, Dave Tippett saw something special there in Edmonton and probably really was excited at the opportunity to work with a Connor McDavid and a Leon Draisaitl and thinking, I've got this strategy in mind that I think can work in Edmonton. And so far, it's paying off. But that's the whole thing. It's that they are one injury away from one of their top six guys from being in a bit of a pickle. And not that you can rely on injuries all the time, but when those situations occur, as we know it happens throughout the hockey season, I do wonder, like, what's Dave Tippett going to be able to do in terms of juggling the system and maybe juggling the lines in order to still get the most out of them. But for now, if you're an Oilers fan, hell, love this. Enjoy it, because how often have you been able to say over the past number of years that your Edmonton Oilers are 5-0 to start the year and you're on top of the division like that? It's been a long time coming, so just enjoy it. You know, don't think too much about playoffs. Right now, the Edmonton Oilers, I think, are providing best value. Like, Zach Kastner.
Don't think about the playoffs.
Yeah.
We in Vancouver are sitting and saying, you know, guys, you and other markets don't get carried away in thinking playoffs. We're sitting here talking. Yeah, a little high horse.
Not really, no, because, like, the Edmonton Oilers still have way more questions to be answering.
Of course.
Right now.
Of course they do.
I think the Canucks have also questions to answer, but they've answered a few over the past two seasons.
This week, though, for the Oilers could set up quite nicely. They play Chicago today, Philly, Detroit, Winnipeg. Like, those are four winnable games.
Yeah, Chicago has not been looking very good to start the season.
Mm.
Like, watching their games, like, yeah, you still see the problems.
Not totally shocking. Just their defense is still so uninspiring. Like, with respect, like, Seabrook and Keith got you Stanley Cups and all, and I get they're beloved in that city, but... Man, they are just not the same, clearly. And then,
I think we figured that the past couple of years.
But then, confusingly, like, they trade Henry Jokiharju in the offseason to Buffalo, and, like, Jokiharju was not perfect.
Some of the bets they've made are very questionable.
He bounced up and down, but...
They had some good draft picks. I like some of the picks they've made. Right. But, yeah, does Stan Bowman know what he's doing with trades? Well, I mean, hey, the one trade they made last year worked out swimmingly for
them. Dylan Strome?
Yeah, getting Dylan Strome. Yeah. So there's a bit of a mixed bag. But, yeah, Chicago early season, a lot of concerns. We'll see how ultimately it goes. We're going to talk a lot more hockey. We'll talk a lot more hockey at the top of the hour. A couple more thoughts to get to. JJ and Fleetwood. Happy Thanksgiving, gents. Can we stop calling Pettersson alien? It doesn't work. How about Marv? Marvin the Martian? That works, no? Marv? Marvin the Martian?
I believe it comes from...
No, I know where it's from. I'm just saying Marvin the Martian? Calling Marv? That's just... That's
if his name was Marvin Pettersson, it would work, but it's not. So, no. Sorry, JJ. Happy Thanksgiving.
Although Pettersson apparently doesn't like the alien nickname too much. So
what?
There might have to be a new nickname for him. Anyways, we're already trying to get a new one for...
Georgia Pettersson. Yes. Yes.
C-O-P. And by the way, shout out to Bick, who was... the first person who coined the phrase Church of Pettersson on this radio station. And then the man himself, the man who has not yet been revealed as...
The Pope?
The Pope.
Yeah.
Went out and obviously took it upon himself to create a real Church of Pettersson. And the Canucks even had a story about this on Canucks.com. And Bick Nizar was mentioned.
Yeah.
He met with Pettersson.
It's not my intention when this started, but that's pretty cool unintended result.
Sometimes you speak it into the air and people, and it happens.
Not many people can say I created a legacy.
I mean, I didn't create no legacy.
We'll see what happens with the legacy, but Bick got a shout out.
See what becomes.
Something will come of this. We're going to talk a lot more hockey at the top of the hour. We'll get to some more of your responses and comments on Twitter as well. How good can Quinn Hughes be in relation to the rest of his draft class? We have a tweet and a comment about that we'll get to as well. Tomorrow, the Canucks host the Detroit Red Wings, and we'll have more to break down at the top of the hour. Canucks are at practice. We'll tell you the latest as far as who's playing where and what to expect tomorrow. No Jacob Markstrom, who, if you've missed it, has left the team to attend to personal family matters. The organization says he's expected to join them again on the road, but it may not be until the weekend when they go to New York to play against the Devils and also to play against the New York Rangers. So we'll keep an eye on it. And Thatcher Demko, well, he's going to get his moment in the spotlight as soon as tomorrow night. We did promise, because it is Thanksgiving, we were going to... You know, we've given thanks to a lot of great things.
Yes.
Living in this beautiful country of ours, this free country, and the fact that we have the freedom of expression, freedom of thought, and freedom to vote for whoever you want. And I do urge you to go out there and rock the vote.
I already voted.
Vote for whatever candidate you believe in. And
write in submission, Satyar Shah.
Yeah, don't vote for me. That's not a smart idea. Trust me. You don't want to see that happening. But vote for whoever makes you happy, whoever you believe in. I don't care who you vote for. Just go out and vote. Take advantage. And I will go do my advance voting today after the show.
Well, take advantage
of it. And also, we are thankful to you for always listening to us and chiming in. So we'll get to a lot more of your submissions. But we promised we're going to take it to the flip side of turkeys, bad turkeys in the NFL. And if you had to choose the biggest turkey in the NFL so far, it could be a team, it could be a player, it could be a circumstance, it could be the league, whatever it is. What's the biggest turkey according to you, John?
sorry, I was going to say Adrian Brown. I'm like, that's not it. Antonio Brown, of course. Antonio Brown. This guy's the biggest Turk. Thank you.
Yeah, there we go.
There he is. That's Antonio Brown.
Yeah.
With another Instagram video. What we've seen out of Antonio Brown is that this guy is absolutely the diva the Steelers were trying to tell us about. And for a while, I thought, you know, maybe he's just sick of Ben. Maybe he's just sick of Tomlin. Maybe this will all change if he just goes to a new team and he's given the money and he's given a chance to be the big star elsewhere. Nope. Not even a little bit. I don't need to go over the Raiders conundrum with you guys. I don't need to go over the Patriots conundrum with you guys. There's still no bigger turkey than AB. What are you doing right now, man? AB, get back in the game.
Yeah, we had numbers on Twitter mentioning Antonio Brown. I mean, he has to be the biggest loser without question. And a similar comment from Silver and Black Canuck, our 650-650 Subway text line, also a Raiders fan who saw the bad, and he says, so many choices for turkey of the year so far in the season. Eli Manning, Antonio Brown, the entire Dolphins organization, and all 14 members of the Chargers fan base. This goes on and on. Yeah, poor
14,
Chargers
fans. Did they gain more followers? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I feel, I mean, watching them play in a soccer stadium, it's just, you know, and it's not full, just.
There's all Steeler fans?
I know, I know, it's just. Man, that's sad. It's
see, the thing
sad,
is with the Chargers, you got to give them credit because they play 16 road games out of the year, and they yeah. that's a big challenge, man. Like that's admirable.
That's who my turkey is.
The LA Chargers,
the LA football Chargers.
Is that Philip Rivers?
Pretty pathetic. well, okay, well, Philip Rivers, that little clown show that he pulled yesterday, kind of trying to mean mug the DB. Like, what are you doing, man? This is the stuff we you know. Get angry about when Cam Newton sighs or something on the sideline. What are you trying to do to the opposing player?
I have no idea,
like
man.
Holding him up at the shoulder pad, trying to drag him around. Get over yourself, man. And
I'm not one of your 13 kids.
That, too. They keep having the same issues. It's like, oh, well, injuries. Well, maybe look in the mirror. Is it your training staff? Is it your rehab staff? Is it the way you prepare? Is it the way you do, go through training camp? I know in the past they've been maligned for not giving their offensive linemen braces in training camp. We know that's one of the leading injuries for offensive linemen is knee injuries in the opening couple of weeks of training camp. They don't do that. There are processes that they can look at if they aren't, that they continually just shoot themselves in the foot. They're the turkey of the NFL, man.
No, they have been. And I have one coming up in a second. I do want to share some more from our listeners. Eric says, the Browns. Okay, that's fair. And
smack.
I know.
But
man.
Is it the Browns or is it?
Well, we'll get to that because Bobby also chimes in and he has another Cleveland Brown, Baker Mayfield, as the biggest turkey. That's fair. It's fair. Anything Browns is fair. If I had to choose one Brown as the biggest turkey, and it's not my biggest turkey because my biggest turkey is somebody else and another team, and I'm going to wear it myself too, but Freddie Kitchens.
Yeah. That's it.
Like if I had to choose the biggest turkey for the Browns, definitely Freddie Kitchens. Does anybody disagree?
No, he's the alpha turkey.
Alpha turkey.
That's it.
That's like a bad one.
That's it. It's a
bad
group of turkeys.
Bad, yeah, no.
Led by the alpha. And that's Freddie Kitchens.
Alpha turkey. Alpha turkey might be a good thing almost. Because that's a turkey that can actually accomplish something. Whereas you are just
okay, this
a straggler
is the beta.
Turkey.
This is the beta turkey.
There we go.
This
I is like the beta turkey better. Right here. Beta turkey is better.
Beta turkey. I don't know why they didn't keep Greg Williams. That's,
oh,
that's all I'm
come
say.
On.
That's
Greg
all I'm
Williams,
say.
Come on. Like, at least if you had somebody else, you would have said, I would have been like, yeah, fine. Greg Williams. Come on. Of all the things, you could have said something else. Greg Williams, no. Could they have hired somebody else?
At least I didn't say Hugh Jackson.
Great. High bar. Very high bar. But my biggest turkey is also a coach, Dan Quinn.
Yeah.
Atlanta Falcons, what are you guys doing? Ooh. You have the talent up front, the defense. Dan, you coached the Seattle Seahawks defense. You showed you're one of the more progressive thinkers defensively. You took your team. You had a 28-3 lead over the New England Patriots. The defense fell apart in the second half. And ever since, the defense has not been right. My biggest turkey, and it goes to a team that's a bird, the Atlanta Falcons, namely Dan Quinn.
More like bad Atlanta. Yeah.
I will say that defense that was so vaunted in those Seattle years, it's almost become extinct.
Yes.
A lot of the teams that are running it now, along the bottom of defensive metrics and total defense as far as efficiency and all that, the only one that's kind of from that school of thinking is Robert Saleh of San Fran, the only one that's really having success with that anymore. Seattle had to change it up and evolve. the people that are still doing that classic Seahawks 2012, 2013, that cover three basic stuff, they're getting shredded nowadays.
Oh, they're getting absolutely killed and no adjustments. That's been my biggest disappointment with Dan Quinn. It's you took over this year, fired all your assistants, and it's like, oh, yeah, you're going to take charge of the defense. Let's see if you make any adjustments. And nothing, if anything, just doubled and tripled down on the same philosophy. That's not working. At what point is it just insanity? That's what I'm seeing so far from the Atlanta Falcons. Because the talent's there. And I do believe at this point you have to start pointing the finger at the head coach.
186 points against. That is worse than the NFL.
Not great, Bob.
Not great at all. Another turkey for me. And this one has been a long time coming. But finally, now that they're 3-3, you can say it with pride and confidence. Jared Goff, man. Jared Goff. Look, we know Jared Goff has a good coach, Sean McVay. But thank you. Thank you. There is Jared post game. Talking about his struggles.
That's not
yards.
An attractive sound, sorry.
It's really not.
No, it's not.
No.
Poor turkey.
I think that's why human beings decided we're going to eat these birds. but Jared Goff, man, and I'm just putting this out there. I think the reality could arrive very soon, if it hasn't already, that Kyler Murray is the second best quarterback in the NFC West. In the four past weeks, sorry, the past 4 weeks, rewording, Kyler Murray's numbers and his offensive line play has only gotten better. It went from 8 sacks to 4 in Seattle, and now he's coming into 0 sack territory. And in this past weekend with 0 sacks, Kyler Murray pops off.
See that pass he made to Sheffield?
Oh,
like, hang on, though. Is that a Kyler Murray thing or is that an Atlanta Falcons thing?
Okay, it might be a Falcons thing because you're right.
I mean, he,
like, Sat just kind of went over the fact that
the
Falcons
too.
The
defense, entire defense
isn't working.
Yeah,
but
it's pretty turkey.
When you are drafted first overall, there is an expectation that you are a skilled quarterback and you are going to help revolutionize what has been not working in Arizona for so long. And if we're just judging based on pure skill, like ability to run multiple looks on an offense, ability to scramble play and actually prolong situations where Jared Goff looks like he's, man, on fire when you put pressure on him. And Jimmy Garoppolo, we have yet to see, like, who the hell is Jimmy Garoppolo? Like, that still hasn't been answered. Whereas with Kyler Murray, yeah, he's been thrust into a pretty uncomfortable situation with a bad O-line there in Arizona, but maybe we're seeing that he can be the second best quarterback in the NFC West, of course, behind Big Russ.
Well, Jared Goff has not been playing well at all. 3-3 for the Rams. They still have a chance, at least, to get back into contention.
Give me
Blake
Bortles.
They're not too far out. But, yeah, no. I don't know if Bortles is any better,
I know,
to be honest
with
you.
That's tongue-in-cheek.
But if we're looking at, say, power rank in the top teams in the NFL, Blake, I did want to get to you on this one because we start looking at the NFL now. The last 2 weeks, the Kansas City Chiefs lost back-to-back home games. This is the first time Andy Reid has lost back-to-back home games as a head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs, and that is going back to 2013. So where do you rank KC in the power rankings, and are the Patriots still number one on your list?
Patriots still number one.
Yeah.
One of the things you're going to have to look at is like what the ankle is for Patrick Mahomes, because it's almost as if the style of play the Chiefs want. Yes, you can get the big play with Tyreek Hill, and we saw how great that touchdown was. But what that does is puts the defense back on. And is this time of possession that they've lost 2 weeks in a row, is it a function of teams being able to run on them and hold the ball, or is it a function of the Chiefs scoring so quickly that the defense just has to go back out? And because I don't know if we can pin this all on the defense. So I want to see, like, what is the state of the ankle? Can they sustain some drives? Can they, you know, build this back towards where they're setting their defense up for success? They're still going to be one of the highest-rated teams for me, within the top six. You know, Packers, pending tonight, will still be involved in that conversation. Seahawks, Cowboys, you know, they're going to be sliding out. But the Saints, we got to start.
I was going to say, I mean, how do you not have the Saints in the top five right now? You have to have them as a top five team. And record-wise, they are one of the top five teams in the league.
Seahawks in this conversation?
Yeah, Seahawks are 5-1. The teams that are 5-1 or better, New England, San Francisco, New Orleans, Seattle, and all five of those teams should be in the top 10.
Yeah.
Even the 49ers for right now.
To me, they're on the back end, but yeah, they're going to be in that conversation.
If I'm putting teams in the top 10, and then tonight I want to see from the Packers as well. I still put the Chiefs in that conversation, maybe a bit lower, because when Holmes gets healthy, they are going to get, he will get better again. And they've had injuries. Tyreek Hill, his first game back, you'll have Watkins being healthier. So their weapons, I still think the Chiefs are going to be really good. But do we start putting, say, the Vikings and the Ravens into that conversation.
Maybe not the Ravens, but Vikings and Panthers should be in that conversation too. The Panthers rattled off four straight with their backup. Massive.
You don't have the Ravens top 10?
No. I think they've slid out.
They're top four in point differential.
We talk a lot about you can lose an impressive game. They've won unimpressive games, really. Mm. Like, yes, they're great in point differential, but that's a, you know, you get to play Miami.
Sure.
That's a benefit to you.
And the Buffalo Bills and even the Houston Texans, in the conversation. Yeah. And the Bills, the offense has to be better for me to look at them as a top 10 team at the moment, power ranking them in the moment right now as we speak. But if that quarterback situation keeps getting better and the offense can produce a bit more, that Bills defense is unreal. It's incredibly good. Well, so give them a lot of credit.
I'm not on the Bills aren't on my top 10 because it's what Bick was saying. Like, it matters who you played against. And yes, they did do a pretty good job against New England Patriots 2 weeks ago, but they played the Jets, the Giants, the Bengals, and the Titans, teams that have been struggling offensively, which is why I think also the defense looks as good as it has. Not trying to take away anything from
But don't forget how good they kept the Patriots at 16 points.
But that, yeah, and that's where they get full credits because you made life pretty miserable for Tom Brady, and that's not easy to do.
No, they also
don't get set up too well for success either because they have an offense that maybe gives them a short field at times, right? Mm. So can you look impressive even in situations where it's up against you?
Fair enough. Yeah.
But, yeah, they're just outside my top 10.
Panthers top 10 for anyone?
For me, yeah.
Yep.
Christian, I know you're big on the Carolina Panthers. The defense is, early on, I'm like, okay, this doesn't look as good as it should. That's really starting to come around. As much as we talk about the offense of Christian McCaffrey, one of the main reasons why they've turned it around after an 0-2 start is that defense coming alive.
Brian Burns has really looked great.
Really
Your
good.
Guy yeah. from the pre-draft process. And Kegley's healthy right now.
Yeah, when he's healthy, one of the best, if not, well,
and,
one
and,
of the best
really,
linebackers in the game.
Where this game is trending now is, you know, can you stay in base personnel and still be athletic? They're able to do that to some degree because they have a guy like Shaq Thompson.
Well, and for instance, and I wasn't the biggest Devin Bush fan in the draft,
sure.
but look at what he's been able to do with the Pittsburgh defense. The only reason the Steelers have two victories is because the defense has helped them out because their offense...
Well, because Phillip Rivers wildly throws a ball for a fumble.
Yes, Phillip Rivers. Turkey! Turkey, sorry. We've had enough turkey talk. It is a special Thanksgiving edition of the Playbook here
gobble,
on Sports in the 650. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. Canucks Central at noon at the top of the hour. Myself and Bick Nazar will break down what we saw from the Canucks over the weekend, looking ahead to the Red Wings tomorrow. And Quinn Hughes is a big topic of conversation. A lot of great comments from you. What's the thing about Quinn that you've liked the most, and how high are you on number 43? We'll discuss right here on the home of the Canucks, Sports in the 650.